our children skipping into the hands of monsters.
Security footage of a paedophile disguised as a school.
You're an Unabomber.
You're a Bunty Man.
She still can't really speak about it.
You're a shrub rocketeer.
Welcome to Pedageddon. It's Friday, it's 5 o'clock. Welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show. Friday the 25th of November 2022, streaming live from the People's Republic of Stokescroft Arts Centre in Bristol and on the talkradio.org.uk stream. Also, radioquk.com in Camberley, Surrey. And live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app, the glorious app, available free from all good app stores, not necessarily Google. So, I'm Tony Gosling, back in the UK, and thank you for turning off the psycho in the corner, gaslighting us with its military-grade Ukraine psyops and COVID treatment prevention. Ugh, nasty one, that is. Psyops, where, as Dr. Tess Laurie has told us, an estimated 60,000 Brits died unnecessarily, because apparently there's no treatment for COVID, if you believe the BBC, followed by God knows how many more now with the poison death jabs, navigating us through the Fourth Reich Matrix, or the World Economic Forum's Fourth Industrial Revolution, is Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. We're doing things sort of slightly back to front this week because we're going to be doing a bit of in-depth stuff to start with and then going into some Bristol stuff towards the end with Joe Banks. But part one, we have two online documentaries being kept off your television by the New World Order. But there's one called Died Suddenly, which is just out, and another one called The Big Reset, both of which fascinating, insightful and censored, because the mainstream media, the mass media, is just basically showing adverts and distractions now. It doesn't really bother with actually telling us what we need to know. So it's a giant, great advertising machine. So what's gone so horribly wrong with our mass media? We look at the British Empire's near takeover of the world to begin with this week, failing and then handing over the job to Israel and the United States, with help from the son of the chief strategist for the US Jewish boycott of Nazi Germany. That is, Jacob Chaitkin was the strategist, Anton Chaitkin is his son. And also looking at Carol Quigley's Tragedy and Hope and The Will of Cecil Rhodes, finance capitalism as a weapon to destroy the nation state. In part two, well, we'll be doing a few bits and pieces, like the history of Ukraine, for example, in part one. Part two, the introduction of Bristol City's centre toll, or CAS, on Monday, which will see small businesses and commuters paying £3,300 a year to operate in Bristol, forcing many to buy new vehicles. The expansion of London's ULEZ zone outwards too, which will be happening here too, of course, in the months and years to come. And the Siemens ANPR cameras tracking us everywhere. Bristol Zoo has closed, and the Central Library is closing too, possibly, and moving. And the poor being forced to pay council tax with money they don't have. Great, that's our good old Labour City for you, run by our Labour marvellous Marvin the Mayor. Also, freelancer Joe Banks will join us to look at 10 Bristol riots over the years and something called the Bristol Anarchy this week. Also, a little bit from Trump in his little speech he gave to say he's going to be running for president. Some interesting anecdotes. At least he's a more entertaining person to listen to, whether you agree with him or not, than that Joe Biden. And we have a bit from Biden too, of course, just to keep it nice and balanced. Iranian and Russian news banned in the UK, of course. Big firewalls around it, like those ones that we criticise China for having, isn't it? First by the telecoms cartel, then by Ofcom, and now cancelled off Bristol Community FM, us too, by the Bristol Mafia. But, thank God, so far, not cancelled here. Martin, I'm going to start off with this piece about the history of the British and the Americans. You were, just before we started, I told you we were doing this, and you said there's actually loads of literature out on this. And the Americans, what Anton Chaitkin posits here, is that the Americans have been, for many years, for centuries actually, trying to do something which is helping countries, other countries, to be independent and to actually stop one nation around the world and empires being dominant. And now the tables are turned. The Americans have now become the empire. But I mean, he's from the LaRouche Public Affairs Committee. I don't know if he's still, I don't think he's still part of it. He's just come out with a book, a much bigger book about the history of the United States. But what do you make of this view before we hear from Anton?
Well, as I say, there's an awful lot of discussion about the relationship between the British and the Americans, as you can imagine, because it's a very important relationship. The Americans broke out of the British Empire in 1776. They went to war with us in 1812 when we were supporting the invasion of Russia and the Americans were supporting the French. And that was, you know, that was the history. And throughout the 19th century until the mid-19th century, there's quite a hostile relationship between the two countries, although lots of trade and cultural links. And ultimately, of course, the Americans wanted to present themselves as anti-imperialists, and that's certainly what they did in World War One with Wilson and his 10 principles, ten principles and so on. But ultimately, the Americans wanted to have the empire. The idea that they were always in favour of not having empires. America itself is an empire. When they broke away from the British in 1780s, they only had the East Coast. They conquered all the rest. They went to war with Mexico. They destroyed every other civilization on that landmass. And they are not to be regarded as anything different from the British Empire. In many ways, they're just a continuation of it.
I mean, you might say a kind of poison child.
Well,
the Israelis.
Well, the imperialism wasn't just a British Anglo phenomenon. You know, the French were imperialists as well. The Germans got in on the act late, but they were pretty vicious. So, you know, nobody can really say. And the Russians, of course, have got a history of imperialism. China too.
But
so
in a way,
there you are.
This whole discussion is rather like the discussion happening today, at least in the alternative press, not, of course, in the mainstream media, who completely turn a blind eye to it, which is this whole idea of the sort of empire, the Western empire, versus this whole idea of having a multipolar world. Well, and we're not talking about having quite so many power centres around, but at least the idea that you don't just have one, that's very bad and very dangerous if one organisation starts to dominate the planet.
Well, I think what you've got is that the US Empire has inherited the British Empire. The British Empire inherited the Dutch Empire. The Dutch Empire inherited the Spanish Empire, which had inherited the Portuguese Empire, but it's all the same empire. And, of course, the Chinese and the Russians were never fully integrated into it, and they had revolutions as part of not wanting to be integrated in it. And, therefore, we've now come full circle. The discovery of America in the 1490s and everything that flowed from that, this is the end of that era, where the West was the dominant force.
Were those revolutions spontaneous, or were they orchestrated in France in China and Russia?
They were orchestrated, of course, by the Communist Party, which had a theory of orchestrating revolutions, which had inherited from the Europeans. And, of course, the French Revolution took place long before all of these things. Chou En-lai was asked in the 1960s what he thought the effects of the French Revolution were, and he said, "It's too early to say."
So it wasn't the Swiss that organised the Russian Revolution and chopped off the head of the Tsar?
Well, why would the Swiss would no doubt involved, because Switzerland being a neutral country is where everybody went to hide out and plot. But of course, and there was lots of plotting. Yes, there certainly was. The Bolsheviks openly said we plotted and plotted. And of course they did.
And what about this whole business of Yale University funding Chairman Mao's book empire? Well, it wasn't really an empire. It was a network of bookshops and publishing houses in China in the 1920s.
In the 1920s, Mao Zedong was not yet a communist. He was still a nationalist. It's not clear that he was a communist. And the Americans were funding lots of things in China because they wanted to control China. And that, don't forget, the British and the Americans and the Japanese put down the Boxer Rebellion in the 1900s. They were all on the same side against China. And that's remembered in China, although much forgotten elsewhere.
Yeah, I noticed also was being sent some videos by Moeen Yassin, an old chum of this show, really. I mean, he was part of one of our colleagues in the 9/11 Truth campaign, and he was showing me how the Turks, now a massively popular TV series in Turkey, is the other version of history from the Ottoman Empire's point of view, which I suppose we're not going to see that in the West here, although apparently there's something, there is a version of it within English subtitles, which I'll see if I can dig out and put a link up to that on our show page, maybe a YouTube film. But, you know, the idea is that actually there's all sorts of history out there. Didn't Oscar Wilde say this? The first duty of any serious historian or journalist is to rewrite history.
Well, of course, that's why we've got history departments in universities. If history is already written, then why would we bother to keep rewriting it? Because that's what we always do for good reason.
Sometimes the job of these departments is to lock history down and not allow it to be criticised.
Well, that is true. So, therefore, if that's what they're doing, it's incumbent on others to make the critical history that they're not making, isn't it?
Very, very refreshing to have a few years ago Bristol University professor on here talking about the links between the merchant venturers and the discovery of America and John Cabot's trip over there in 1497. So, you know, digging out, actually getting, and also finding out who financed it, which was a bank in Florence. So anyway, let's forget that for a minute, because we're going to be looking now at the British Empire and the United States Empire and the rivalry, as Anton Chaikin sees it, over the centuries.
For the last 500 years, we'll just limit it to that, there are two opposing ways of looking at mankind and two opposing ways of organizing the affairs of the people. One way is most strongly exemplified by the British Empire. They do things in one way. The other way is the American Revolution and the Union side in the Civil War. Everything that you have been taught in recent times is to try to avoid looking at the world that way. The British Empire, at the time of the American Revolution, what kind of business were they in? What did they do? What was their economic activity of the British Empire?
Trade.
They were trade. They talked about trade. They had ships that would bring things from one place to another. They were also in the insurance business. What did they sell? Well, one thing that they sold was slaves, black slaves. They had a company called the Royal African Company. It was founded by the Duke of York, and they used to brand the slaves DY. They also got into opium sales, and that became bigger later on. But they were doing that already at the time of the American Revolution. They would also corner the market in certain commodities and take them from somebody cheap and sell them at a higher price somewhere else by somehow rigging something the best that they could. And that was their whole mode of operations. In other words, forms of criminal activities. Now, sometimes today, you'll get some crackpot who will say, you can't judge people in those days by today's standards. Why not? Today's standards are a lot worse than they were then. What are you talking about? These guys run the place now more than they did then. At least then we had a fight against that. Because in those days they were looked on as criminal. Nobody ever thought the slave trade was a decent thing to do. It was a criminal activity. Everybody knew that. That was one side. Now, I want this to be crystal clear so there's no way to escape from it, okay? There was a revolution against that in the colonies. Who were the leaders of that revolution? Well, according to the communists, according to Jefferson Davis, and according to the British, all three of whom say exactly the same thing, the leaders of the American Revolution were a bunch of slave owners and slave traders, right? All of the Southern secessionists, the Communist Party and the British Empire all say exactly the same thing. And it's picked up on a lot of popular radio stations and so forth, and a lot of rap artists and so forth. The American Revolution was led by slave owners and slave traders. Okay. Supposing that's not true, then what? Then you've got a real bad problem on your hand, don't you? Got a real bad problem. You might have to pay attention to history. It might mean something to you, instead of just being a big ripoff. Oh, well, we don't have to learn anything about history because it's just a big ripoff. The world is a big ripoff. Don't you know Satan runs the world? No, Satan doesn't run the world. God runs the world.
Who's God? Which God?
the God that created the world. I don't know what his proper name is, but I know that there's a God who created this world.
Well, you believe in magic.
All right, now, there was an alternative to the British Empire, and it goes all the way back to the Renaissance. Three principal leaders of the American Revolution: George Washington, Benjamin Franklin, and Alexander Hamilton. Take the revolution from the time of the formation of the organization, led by Franklin, all the way through the Constitution, principally led by Hamilton. Start with George Washington. George Washington, and these are the three principal leaders of the organization of our country, the beginning, the war against England, and the creation of a national government. Start with George Washington, the most important Southern politician we've ever had, right? Don't tell me about Jefferson Davis. George Washington is the most important Southern politician. Anybody who says the Confederacy represents the South is coming from the standpoint of British Freemasonry. George Washington, you couldn't get more Southern. He inherited a slave plantation, right? Born in the South, born in Virginia. What did he dedicate himself to do? To undermine and replace a worldwide British system of slavery. The whole world was a slave system in the British Empire way of thinking. What was his idea? He said, instead of having the cheapest possible labor and the cheapest possible raw materials that we grab from somewhere and sell somewhere else, and that's what we were supposed to do according to Adam Smith, what George Washington said is, let us have canals. He personally did the route for the Erie Canal. He led the fight for a canal out to the Ohio. He said, let us grow corn and wheat. Let us have fisheries. Let us have roads. Let us build industry. And let us have a war against the British Empire, because we've got to have a modern society. His farewell address was an address against listening to intriguers who would want to have secession. Okay, that's George Washington. Benjamin Franklin and Alexander Hamilton, the two of them, were the originators of the anti-slavery society in the United States. Alexander Hamilton, born in the West Indies, the son of unmarried parents, not an aristocrat, possibly of black ancestry, came to America and had a program for opposing the British world slave system. Because he hated slavery. He saw it all around him in the Caribbean. And he did something that the British never forgave him for, never forgave America for. He set up a national bank of our country, a bank of the Republic, the Bank of the United States, which he personally controlled as Treasury Secretary for Washington. And what's the idea of that? Well, if there are international bankers that charge 10-20% interest, no problem. You have your own bank that charges 3% and gets loans out to people who want to build industry and farming. And what's the purpose of industry, according to Alexander Hamilton? And this gets back, again, to the fight with these guys. What's the purpose of having industry and industrial development and technological progress? As he defined it in his report on manufacturers, he said, the purpose of having this industrial development is to have the human mind improved. Because if we live in a natural society, that is a peasant society, where people keep their place in nature and their place vis-a-vis the aristocrats, then each man is an idiot. Each man is maintained as an idiot by his superiors. So therefore, how do you change that? By having variegated, various, thriving, constantly new industries of a powerful industrial type with hundreds and thousands and millions of companies and private farms. And you do that in a country that gets power from that, and you have many countries that have power. And any country can do that and have their own national bank, and therefore not have international bankers dictating to that country. That's the basis for nationalism of a positive type. Now, if anybody says that these people were the slave party or slave owners, and that defines them, not only is it a lie, but it's coming from the British, who were the inventors, at least in our modern times, of the slave system.
So that's Anton Chaikin, son of Jacob Chaikin, who's the chief strategist of the American Jewish boycott of Nazi Germany. And he was one of the researchers for the LaRouche Public Affairs Committee, more recently author of a great tome on... be interesting to try and get him to talk about that. In fact, I think there are some interviews around already about this book he's just got out about the history of the United States. But, Martin, what would you make of what he's saying there, really effectively saying, look, the Americans tried to set up a separate country which wasn't dominated by the international bankers all the way back then?
They certainly... There are elements within the American revolutionary tradition which are quite radical, and he's obviously put his finger on some of them. One of the things he didn't mention is that the way they industrialized in the United States of America is they refused British free trade. So British industrial goods, when Britain dominated the world of industry, we were the workshop of the world that China now is. The Americans said, we're not going to have cheap industrial products from Britain. We're going to keep them out, and we're going to build up our own industry.
It sounds a bit Trump-like, is it?
It's a bit Trump-like in a way, but Trump, of course, is trying to repeat the trick.
Yeah. It's a different era.
Two centuries on, and it's not the same thing. And the Germans and the Japanese did exactly the same thing. And ultimately, of course, both the Chinese and the Russians did exactly the same thing. They withdrew from the international capitalist system in order to go back in on a different terms. But it's not free market at all. It's absolutely against the free market. In actual fact, it makes Jeremy Corbyn look positively pink.
Yeah. Anton Chaikin goes on to talk about sovereignty, what this really means, and also he has some suggestions about how to defeat inflation.
Your country has sovereignty. Your nation has a sovereign power based on the people, right? The people constitute themselves the nation. The nation, hopefully an elected government of responsible leaders, has a certain kind of sovereignty. This sovereignty has a crucial decision to make. And that decision is, what shall we do with the credit power of our country, of our sovereign nation? Because that decision decides almost everything. You could go two directions. You could either use your credit power as it should be used, as a power to hire people to work productively so that they can do agriculture and industry and inventions and science and teach children to be scientific and inventive, to be geniuses, hopefully, a lot of them. That's what you use credit for. Or you say that credit is there for those who are powerful, to use as they desire. And those who have a power that is apart from that type of national sovereignty idea and development idea are of necessity gangsters. So there are really two systems of credit: the system of national sovereignty and development, or the crime system. So if you say, I don't know what the money was used for in a country, you've missed the crucial distinction, the basic distinction.
Sent back to the United States.
Yeah, they sent the money back to the United States, going through certain corrupt local hands and so forth. But they end up sending the money back to these banks, right? And to criminal circles as well. They also, a lot of it gets into the drug circle, the drug circuit. That's the crucial thing, that distinction on the use of credit. And when Lincoln made greenbacks and credit available in large quantities, contrary to what is promoted in our Economics 101 courses, they claim that caused inflation. On the contrary, the system of massive credit to set up factories and farms to get people productive, that system is the only way to defeat inflation, because you set up a power, an engine of production, so that every year steel becomes cheaper because you make it better. You have more modern facilities. You know how to do things better. And you charge less for a product of industry because you can make a profit making more of it and making it better. That's how you beat inflation, is by more brains. You don't beat inflation by stopping people from having credit.
beat inflation by having more brains. What does he mean by that? And is he right?
Well, inflation is a symptom of other problems in the economic system. It's not a problem in itself. It's a symptom of other problems.
Well, it is a problem if, for example, you're on benefits and your benefits aren't rising in line with inflation. Yes, it's a massive problem. But that's, in fact, it means you can't feed your kids, doesn't it?
Of course it does, and therefore inflation is... there are two... You've got inflation and deflation, which he hasn't mentioned there. Yeah, deflation is when prices are dropping. And, of course, you can get stagflation, which what you got in the 90s in Russia, where inflation was 1,000%, but everybody was thrown out of work and not given any benefits. It was a disaster. But, of course, that kind of disaster is always potentially there if the economic system breaks down. And there's various... I don't believe, as he doesn't believe, that it's just money chasing too few goods that causes inflation. The real problem with inflation is you've got bottlenecks in your system which allow monopolies to pass on price and, you know, cost increases as price increases, because it isn't a free market. And, of course, if you've got banks at the top who get bailed out with quantitative easing and all the rest of it. But, of course, he's quite right that you could have a country where the government issues the currency. That is not the case in the West. The banks create the currency, and the government then mops up
surely,
the mess.
Hang on, it's the Bank of England, isn't it?
No, it isn't. It isn't.
Well, when I
no, that's what it says in the textbook that you read 30 or 40 years ago, but it's not true. It hasn't been true for a long time. The big bang in the City of London and all the rest of it, it was already incipient. And there was a situation from the end of the Second World War until the 70s where the private banking system was more controlled. It was. But they broke out of that. They broke out of it years ago. And, of course, they shouldn't be allowed to. And you could... I'm all in favour of the kind of currency reforms he's suggesting. The only thing I would say about that is it's not a silver bullet. Having a proper attitude towards the government creation of credit, like in China, for example, where the banks ultimately and the credit list ultimately belongs to the government, unlike the West. So, for example, they can just cancel it if they want to, because it's money they owe to themselves. Can you see what advantage that gives you? But it's not enough on its own. And what he's not mentioning there is the way you have to, you've got to have an economic plan, which may involve things like tariff barriers and so on. Yeah. The Zollverein in Germany allowed all these little countries that were made up Germany to trade amongst themselves without any barriers, but they had put up a barrier to the outside world, a bit like the EU does.
I mean, our economic plan at the moment seems to be to bankrupt everybody except the super rich and the big Amazons, the transnationals.
Well, what's happening is that the European model of having, the single market and all the rest of it is being comprehensively trashed by, guess who, the Americans and the British. They don't want that model. It's going to go. So this war with Russia, as Hudson has pointed out, is actually about smashing Germany. This is all a rerun of World War II.
Well, I mean, actually, Michael Hudson talks about this as a battle of two different systems going on in Ukraine, isn't it? And I can definitely see that you've got, you know, dominant finance capitalism in the West, which thinks that money can absolutely do anything, buy up the press, buy up the political parties, and just create policy for itself, as against... On the eastern side of this particular divide in Ukraine, you've got people who don't believe that. They believe that governments should be strong enough to stand up to these financial interests.
That's true, but of course, even in China and Russia, there are elements within ruling elites which are quite, which would like to align with the Western way of doing things. Well, so it's not that straightforward. But on the other hand,
you've also got vice versa, haven't you? Yeah. You've got a bit of vice versa too.
Oh, yeah, you do. I mean, we're in a very serious economic crisis now in Europe because of all of these sanctions that have been put on Russia are not doing Russia any harm at all, but they're destroying all of the economy.
Yeah, particularly
of
Germany. I mean,
Germany is definitely going to have the biggest fall because they were the strongest. So when they become...
Well, they were also very, very reliant on the Russian gas for all sorts of good reasons.
Right.
This was welding the two countries together.
It's the tyranny of geography, isn't it? In actual fact, Russia is not that far away. We think of it as somewhere like the moon. And when I visited there as a teenager in the 70s, it was like visiting the moon. But of course, that's no longer the case. And of course, it's much closer to us than the good old United States of America, which is on the other side of a very, very big pond.
Anyway, whilst we're talking about Ukraine, I thought it'd be really useful to do another one of these little deep analyses in our part one today by having listened to one of my favourite people of all time. He's Professor Kees van der Peel. He spoke to us about, for example, he's done a book on the MH17 crash disaster being shot down, which he believes is just basically a NATO stitch-up. And he was at Sussex University, I think, for quite a while. But here he is talking on Germ Warfare, which is a podcast that I was on a few weeks ago, talking about secret societies. And Kees van der Peel talking about the history of Russia and Ukraine.
In 1922... when the Soviet Union was formed, a large part of southern Russia was added to the original Ukraine. Roughly the river Dnieper, you know, the river, a very broad river on which Kiev is located.
It's sort of in the middle.
Yeah, exactly. It cuts right in the middle of Ukraine, and everything to the right of that was formerly Russia. And that was 1922. And I once asked somebody who really knows things about this prehistory, and he said to me that probably the reason was that the Bolsheviks in power were concerned about the role of the Cossacks, and that they wanted to have a large area in which several nationalities were represented, and the entire Cossack population was represented as well. But I can't judge that because I have no independent knowledge. And in 1954, Khrushchev, as they said, in a drunken mood, gave away Crimea also to Soviet Ukraine. Although Crimea was a favorite destination for Russians who were about to retire and wanted to enjoy the warm climate. It's a Riviera of on the Black Sea.
So it was mostly Russian.
Crimea. Oh yeah, yeah, and a remnant, of course, of the Tatars, because Crimea was the last part of the Tatar Empire that once existed, which was actually inhabited by Tatar in spite of the forced removal of the Tatars by Stalin, because the communist leadership was very suspicious of the Ukrainians all along, and they were always, well, for instance, one of the reasons why the Soviet leadership decided to intervene in Czechoslovakia in 1968, when there was a modernization movement, very heterogeneous, was because the leader of Ukraine, who was represented, of course, in the Politburo in Moscow, said, if we allow Czechoslovakia to go its own way, Ukraine might also want to do that. And we can't run that risk. So one of the reasons why there was a narrow majority in the Politburo in Moscow to clamp down on the modernization policy in Czechoslovakia was, again, the potential unreliability of Ukraine. And, of course, the most dramatic form of that unreliability had been the fact that in western Ukraine, so west of the river Dnieper, there were many people welcoming the Nazis when they invaded in June 1941. So I wasn't even chronological, but you probably see we have an area here which is charged with identity politics.
It's completely different.
Yeah.
The two sides are very different.
Yeah, yeah. And the eastern, the people who are heroes for the western part are villains for the eastern part, and vice versa. Like, for instance, the leadership in the Second World War of the Ukrainian West, who collaborated with the Nazis and committed, as I said, unspeakable crimes against Jews, against Poles, and against communist Russians.
This was inside Ukraine?
Yeah.
So why is Crimea still so important?
Well, it is like, a solid aircraft carrier commanding the whole Black Sea. So there's no way that Sebastopol, which is the location of the Black Sea fleet of Russia, Sebastopol has a very heroic history of its own. You know, the Nazis, of course, wanted to conquer it. There was a fight, I forget the length, I think almost a year, to get hold of Sebastopol. It had to do also with the birthday of Hitler, etc. The Germans had their best commander, Manstein, leading the attack, and even he didn't succeed in conquering it. Now, after the collapse of the Soviet Union, the Black Sea Fleet was still in Sebastopol. Of course, it was now part of Ukraine. So they concluded for several decades, a lasting agreement, a lease, in which, in exchange for cheap gas, Russia could use facilities of the naval base of Sebastopol.
So then, and the Crimea is obviously still important, as we know, and we'll get to that in a moment, but also the east of Ukraine.
They're both the Donbas. It means the basin of the river Don, and it's Luhansk and Donetsk.
That's right, Luhansk, there we go.
These are the provinces, but other areas like the province of Kharkov and Odessa, for instance, on the Black Sea coast, they are also Russian dominated, so they have a long history of association with Russia. And don't forget that the whole eastern, so the Russian part, was the center of the industrialization drive in the late 1920s and 1930s. So whereas Western Ukraine is primarily agricultural, although there are also important factories in Lviv or Lvov or Lemberg, as it was called when it was still Austria. The heavy industries are typical of the East. So we have Zaporozhye, Kharkov with its tank factories, etc. This is a mining area, steel factory area. That was extremely important in the Soviet era. So Khrushchev, for instance, was an Ukrainian. He made his career in Ukraine. But other later leaders also had association with Ukraine. And many people who made their career in the eastern part of Ukraine went on to become very important people in the all Soviet leadership in Moscow. So it's a crucial area for historical reasons. It's a problematic area. It has produced some of the key leadership of the entire Soviet Union, and in that respect, it resembles what many empires have had in the form of frontier area. So you had the Roman frontier area, you had the Chinese frontier area, and these frontiers were always the place where people lived who understood life inside the empire and life outside the empire. And yes, because they had that broader view, they were often superior to the people who were completely at home in either one. And
right.
I think that also Ukraine actually means, I'm not a linguist, but I've been told Ukraine means borderland. So it was the borderland, at least in the east, of the Russian Empire, just as it was a borderland of the Austro-Hungarian Empire in the west.
Yes.
There, another part of a prehistory comes into play, and that is that NATO, in breach of all the assurances that were given in 1989, NATO advanced until inside former Soviet Union with the Baltic states, but also in 2008 at the summit in Bucharest, Ukraine and Georgia were promised membership of NATO, and that was in 2008. And 1 year before, that is 2007, Putin gave a speech at the annual security conference in Moscow, where he explained that Russia would no longer tolerate NATO advance into the former Soviet territory, for the simple reason that no state can accept that its security would be jeopardized in that way. And well, history has shown ever since. I mean, in 2008, France and Germany, even my own little Holland, were still against that plan, so they vetoed it. Germany and France vetoed the idea of allowing Georgia and Ukraine to become NATO members. But in the period since, it has become more and more clear that this NATO membership is no longer illusory in the longer run. And there, the most important date is 2014.
So that's Professor Kees van der Peel, VanDerPijl, and really giving us, I suppose, a bit of an insight into the history of Ukraine. And this, it sounded to me when he's talking about it, Martin, a little bit like Northern Ireland, you know, because this is somewhere which for many years has had these two very different communities antagonistic towards each other. Obviously, there are possibilities of peace between them, but there's also it's also possible that the powers that be might like to drive a wedge between the two and get them fighting.
That's true, but I would compare it more to Yugoslavia, because in the Ukraine, you've got two major ethnic groups, if you like, but it's actually, because it's such a big place, you've got lots of other ethnic groups. So there's the Hungarians and Romanians in western Ukraine, who used to be part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire and not that keen to be part of the Ukraine. And there used to be a big Polish minority north of Kiev, but they were all killed in the war by the OUN.
You get his point, though, that this is a country which has always been quite divided down this Dnieper River from east to west, with the east antagonistic towards the west. And also, of course, what makes it in a way worse is that there were this antagonism in the Second World War as well. With part of it being pro-Nazi, another part being pro-Soviet Union, pro-Stalin.
Well, that's right. Well, in Yugoslavia, the Croats and the Kosovans sided with the Germans. So there was a Kosovan SS battalion, and the Serbs were the backbone of the communist resistance. So all of these things, you know, there's a lot of similarities. It's a very different geography in one sense, because Yugoslavia is very mountainous and you've got lots of, you know, more ethnic groups crammed in there. Ukraine is very flat, but many of these problems are inherited from that era, and going back to the Russian Revolution as well. Can I just mention a couple of things before we move on that I picked up? Most of that I agreed with. I think the Russianization of the Donbass didn't just begin after the Russian Revolution. It was the heartland of industrialization in Russia before the Industrial Revolution. And in fact, before the Russian Revolution, yeah. And in the 1880s, a Welsh guy called Hughes went out there and built the first steelworks in Russia. And then what's now called Donetsk was originally called Hughesovka after him. Okay? So in other words, the Russian, The Ukrainian language is a Ruthenian language. It's related. It's all Slavic, but it's written with a different script. So they use the same script we do, unlike Russian. And they tend to be uniate Catholics, whereas the Russians tend to be Orthodox. But this split goes back a long way. before the Russian Revolution. What was it? One of the things that's similar between Yugoslavia and Ukraine is that these borders, which were decided by communists on the basis of what they wanted to manipulate, you know, so they gave more Russians into what the Ukrainian SSR, because they didn't want the Ukrainians to have an SSR on their own with not, but you know, they wanted the Russians to outnumber them, basically. Yeah. So that they couldn't do anything they didn't like. But of course, and then Khrushchev really put the cherry on the cake by giving Crimea, which is overwhelmingly Russian, to the Ukraine.
Well, this is an interesting motive. Yeah, but this is an interesting motive, isn't it? Which I certainly haven't heard discussed anywhere else, was the idea that the reason that the Moscow leadership of the Soviet Union was adding bits to Ukraine was to make it more Russian, to make it more, you know, because they were worried that actually, oh, crikey, we've got, you know, we've got quite a lot of far right. We've got some Hitler supporters and stuff in the east of Ukraine, in the west of Ukraine.
It's not just that.
And we don't want, you know, we want Russia to be able to dominate this country a bit more. We're a bit nervous that they might turn against us.
Don't forget, a lot of the West Ukraine was never in either the Russian Empire or the Soviet Union before the revolution.
It was in Poland instead.
Yes, there were some parts of it were part of Poland. Lviv is actually, I went to Lvov when it was called Lvov in 1976.
God.
And that was actually, before, historically, that was a Polish Jewish place. But of course, because of the Second World War, the Poles were driven out and the Jews were all murdered by the Ukrainians. So, I mean, you've got similar history in Yugoslavia. So you end up having people fighting over borders which were actually designed to create a sort of, you know, there were some historical reasons for these borders, but they're very, very disputable. And the idea that the Ukraine, as we now talk about it, is an independent country with no, you know, there's the outside forces of the Russians coming in and trying to bully them around. This was always a powder keg waiting to explode. Always a powder keg waiting to explode. And I actually predicted in the book that I wrote, it came out in 1998 with my friend Laszlo Andor, who's Hungarian. We predicted that there would be a civil war in the Ukraine if the West didn't change course.
Seems that we keep making similar mistakes, or the same mistakes, again and again, doesn't it?
Well, it's not mistakes. I think it's quite deliberate.
Well, I mean, you know, to allow this sort of thing to happen, for these ethnic differences to be allowed to fester in this fashion, and then, people coming to blows for these various geopolitical purposes. I think one of the main reasons for that, particularly today, is the appalling behaviour of the mass media. I mean, I've never seen anything quite like as bad as what we're getting at the moment, which is extremely controlled. There's no proper debate. There's a very controlled discussion. We've got this woman, isn't it, in the BBC, Mariana Spring, who's their fake news controller or something. And I noticed that, who was it? I think it was Mark Curtis was saying, oh, yes, Mariana Spring, the BBC's disinformation reporter, is a bit like ISIS having an anti-terrorism officer.
Yes. Well, I mean, I think what's happening is because this is a weaponization of our society. You know, the head of the British Army, I've forgotten his name, was saying that the British people don't realise that we're at war and we're going to have to change our attitude because we're going to war with Russia. And I don't know why he thinks it's his place to come out with stuff like that, but he has. And, most people have not really cottoned on to the fact that we are being driven down the slippery slope here.
Yeah, well, I misquoted Mark Curtis there. He says, it still makes me laugh that the UK state news has a disinformation correspondent, which is a bit like ISIS having a terrorism prevention officer. So that's his actual quote. Mm. But also interesting that Kees van der Peel, who I interviewed earlier this year about his book, The Pandemic of Angst, which is a fantastic, look at the idea that the elites of the world knew that as they, you know, introduced this more fascistic top-down control, that the masses were going to rise up. So they had to have some sort of way of controlling that. Is also, Martin, if you go back a few years, he was in the Daily Mail. Sussex University is investigating a professor after he claimed Israel were behind the September the 11th attacks with help from Zionists in the US government. Professor Kees van der Peel, the former head of international relations at Sussex, used his source as an article entitled 9/11, Israel Did It, by conspiracy theory site Wikispooks. Yeah, we're big fans of Wikispooks, actually. Conspiracy theory site? No! They're bullshit investigators, as I keep being told by the New Zealanders. Bullshit investigators. They're not at all conspiracy theorists, which also claims that Al-Qaeda is a front from the Mossad, the Israeli spy service.
Well, I mean, these are you know, these are things that can be openly discussed and should be openly discussed. I don't think it's just Mossad that run Al-Qaeda. It was created by the Brits. Operation Cyclone, MI6 were the lead agency
in
all of it.
I mean, I think it almost think, again,
I should put up
a link to the Wikispooks article, 9/11, Israel did it, because it's got such a tremendous amount of information in there that you will not see almost anywhere else. And you can make your own mind up. We're not telling you what to believe. Of course, we would never even dream of doing that here. You know, that's Kees van der Peil for you. That's what he said. I think he was removed from Sussex for posting that, as, of course, we had the similar, in fact, it was exactly the same post, wasn't it, that Stephen Sizer, the Reverend Stephen Sizer from Virginia Water, was removed by, or told to never mention the Middle East in his sermons by the bosses of the Anglican Church after he posted the same article.
Yes, and of course we've got David Miller here, who's been removed as a professor at Bristol University. But he didn't even go as far as saying 9/11 was carried out by the Israelis. He just annoyed them
he was talking about the Israel lobby being involved in the student groups at the universities, actually being funded from the Israeli state. So they're not just a Jewish lobby, they're an Israeli state lobby, which makes it extremely difficult to deal with. Anyway, we're going to look at both of these before we end of part one, which is the infiltration and the problems with journalism, and the infiltration and the problems, structural problems with universities too. First of all, with the, I wish I could remember her name, I'll see if I can dig it out for you, the lovely Dutch lady that put together this Who Runs the World video, and here she talks about journalism, controlling the world of journalism, BlackRock and Vanguard.
Someone like me, who never makes videos, can with an old laptop objectively show that only two companies hold a monopoly in all industries in the world. My question is, why is this never talked about in the media? We can choose daily between all sorts of documentaries and TV programs, but none of them cover this subject. Is it not interesting enough? Or are there other interests at play? Wikipedia again gives us the answer. They say that about 90% of the international media is owned by 9 media conglomerates. Whether we take the monopolists Netflix and Amazon Prime, or enormous concerns that own many daughter companies like Time Warner, the Walt Disney Company, Comcast, Fox Corporations, Bertelsmann and Viacom CBS, we see that the same names own the stocks. These corporations not only make all the programs, movies and documentaries, but also own the channels on which those are broadcast. So not only the industries, but also the information is owned by the elite. I will show you briefly how this works in the Netherlands. To start with, all the Dutch mainstream media are owned by 3 companies. The first one is the Persgroep, the parent company of the following brands. Apart from the many newspapers and magazines, they also own Sanoma, the parent company of some of the big commercial Dutch channels. Many media outlets from abroad, like VTM, are also owned by the Persgroep. The second one is Mediahuis, one of Europe's biggest media concerns. In the Netherlands, Mediahuis owns the following brands. Until 2017, also Sky Radio and Radio Veronica were owned by Mediahuis, as were Radio 538 and Radio 10. And then there's Bertelsmann, which is one of the 9 biggest media firms. This company owns RTL, that owns 45 television stations and 32 radio stations in 11 countries. But Bertelsmann is also co-owner of the world's biggest book publisher, Penguin Random House. The stocks of these companies are owned by private funds of three families. Those are the Belgian Van Tillo family, the Belgian Leysen family, and the German Bertelsmann Mohn family. All three families sided with the Nazis in the war, according to Wikipedia. For this reason, the Telegraaf, the Leysen newspaper, was temporarily forbidden in the Netherlands after the war. To complete this overview, look at where the news comes from. The daily news of all these media outlets, the diverse news media, do not produce news. They use information and footage from the press agencies ANP and Reuters. These agencies are not independent. ANP is owned by Talpa, John de Mol. Thomson Reuters is owned by the powerful Canadian Thomson family. The most important journalists and editors working for these agencies are a member of a journalism agency like the European Journalism Centre. These are one of the biggest European sponsors of media-related projects. They educate journalists, publish study books, provide trainee spaces and press agencies, and work closely together with the big corporations, Google and Facebook. For journalistic analysis and views, the big media use Project Syndicate. This is the most powerful organization in the field. Project Syndicate and organizations like I mentioned are together with the press agencies the link between all worldwide media outlets. When news anchors read from their autocues, chances are that the text stems from one of these organizations. That is the reason that worldwide media shows synchronicity in their reporting.
Plaguing our country.
The sharing of biased and false news has become all too common on social media. More alarming, some media outlets publish these same fake stories without checking facts first.
The sharing of biased and false news
has become all too common on social media.
More alarming, some media outlets publish these things that simply aren't true without checking facts first.
Unfortunately, some members of the media platforms push their own personal bias and agenda to control exactly what people think.
And this is extremely dangerous to our democracy.
This is extremely dangerous to our democracy.
And look at the European Journalism Center itself. Again, the Gates Foundation and the Open Society Foundation. They are also heavily sponsored by Facebook, Google, the Ministry of Education and Science, and the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. Who sponsors the organization and press agencies that produce our news? With Project Syndicate, we see the BMGF, the Open Society Foundation, and the European Journalism Center. The organizations that bring the news get paid by non-profit organizations of the same elite that also owns the entire media. But also a part of taxpayers' money is used to pay them. In Belgium, there are protests regularly since Media House and the Perscoop receive millions of euros from the government, while many are abroad. As a closing note, we take our Dutch public broadcasting service, NPO. Criticism that it is a mouthpiece of the government, that in itself could be a mouthpiece of the big corporation, is not unfounded. The chairman of the supervisory board of the NPO is Tjibbe Joustra. He wrote the electoral platform for the VVD, a right-wing liberal party. Former VVD leader Ed Nijpels was chairman of AvroTros. VVD legislator Erik van den Burg is chairman of the NTR. Former chairman of the VVD Bas Eenhoorn is now chairman of WNL. Former PvdA State Secretary Martijn van Dam controls the distribution of benefits to the NPO and sits in the board of the NPO. Former chairman of the PvdA is now in the supervisory board of the VARA. CDA politician Paul Roep is chairman of the supervisory board of KRO and CRV. The partner of D66 minister Ollegren, Irene van Brekel, is editor-in-chief of the news comedy Lubach. Former news anchor Pia Dijkstra is now a member of parliament for D66. Well, this was a lot to chew on, and I tried to make it as short as I could. I only used examples that I thought were necessary to create a clear overview. This helps to better understand our current situation, that can shed new light on past events. There will be enough time to dive into the past, but now let's talk about today. But my goal is to inform you about the danger we are in now. The elite governs every aspect of our lives, also the information we get, and they depend on a coordination cooperation to connect all industries in the world to serve their interests. This is done through the World Economic Forum, among others, a very important organization. Every year in Davos, the CEOs of big corporations meet national leaders, politicians and other influential parties like UNICEF and Greenpeace. In the supervisory board of the WEF is former President Al Gore, our own Minister Kaag, Fijke Sijpsma, chairman of the Royal Dutch State Mines, and the commissioner of DNB, the Dutch Bank. Christine Lagarde, chairwoman of the European Central Bank. Also politician Bert Grapperhaus' son works for the WEF. Wikipedia says that the annual fee for members is X euros. But over half of her budget comes from partners who pay the cost for politicians who otherwise could not afford membership. Wikipedia also mentions this. According to critics, the WEF is for rich businesses to do business with other businesses or with politicians. For most members, the WEF would support personal gain instead of being a means to solve the world's problems. Why would there be many world problems if the industry leaders, bankers and politicians from 1971 onwards have gathered every year to solve the world's problems? Isn't it illogical that after 50 years of meetings between environmentalists and the CEOs of the most polluting companies, nature is gradually doing worse, not better? That those critics are right is clear when we look at the main partners that together make up more than half of the budget of the WEF.
So all roads lead to the World Economic Forum, apparently, Martin. But it is, I think she's done a superb job there in breaking down. I mean, obviously, this is the Dutch media she's talking about. But the involvement of these BlackRock and Vanguard, also the monopolisation, not just of journalism, but of training of journalism with this organisation called the European Journalism Foundation, which is doing so much of the training, organising the courses for the journalists. And I just wonder just how critical these journalists are. But anyhow, I think it's amazing that she sort of wound up there by talking about World Economic Forum. Everything seems to lead there.
Well, that's what you can see, isn't it? There's all sorts of stuff going on. The World Economic Forum is like the tip of the iceberg, isn't it, in terms of what's really going on. Of course, one of the things she didn't mention there is the active role of intelligence services in shaping the journalistic environment on behalf of the big corporations.
Absolutely right, yeah. Well, they seem to be very close, actually. I can remember many years ago...
It's a revolving door.
Well, The Independent publishing a story which... caused a bit of controversy at the time. It's probably 12, 15 years ago, where they're saying, well, the MI6 is advertising to big corporations, so saying, would you like to sort of partner with us and we will see if we can use our intelligence facilities to help you, make money, basically, and, sort of sort your markets out, do intelligence on your competition and integrating these big companies in with the intelligence operations. So I think that line that used to divide these things and, from government to corporations, whether it's military or civil policymaking government, it seems to be dissolved.
Yeah, well, if you look on the purely military side, there's increasing use of private military companies, and that's part of the same process. The CIA is no longer just one organisation, for example. It's a whole alphabet soup of contractors, all of whom have to have supposedly security clearance and all the rest of it.
Anyway, her name is Vrouwen Vorviel, which is an absolutely dreadful pronunciation, probably. Better that I spell it, really. V-R-O-U-W-E-N V-O-O-R V-R-I-J-H-E-L-D. Okay, so that's Vjorn Vjeld. She doesn't make a big song and dance about her name, but she's actually quite well known in Holland. I think she's done an absolutely amazing job and just pulling apart. And that's the last word. I mean, because we did play that last year, that when it first came out, this Who Runs the World. And I've had over the last couple of weeks a couple of clips from it, because sometimes these things just, it's a grower. It's a real grower. And she's done, I think, a brilliant job in just explaining, look, guys, look at who owns the stock in all these companies. I'm also reminded of the Bristol Merchant Venturers looking at BlackRock and Vanguard, because there's a similar thing where it's quite difficult to find out who actually owns the shares. Apparently BlackRock is open. Many of the shares are owned by Vanguard. But when you look at Vanguard, what she says, this massive company, trillions of assets. Well, hang on, that you can't see who the shareholders are, because it's a private company. It's private individuals that hold the shares. It's not a stock market floated business at all. And so everything suddenly disappears at the end of the trail. Everything's, well, gosh, we just don't know who owns these shares. Rather important that we do know. So there she is. Thanks ever so much for that. A brilliant piece of work. And anything else anyone knows of by her, let us know, and we'll see if we can put it on here. But there's another aspect to all of this we're looking at in part one this week, and that is the control of the universities. The way that the universities, Martin, have changed over the last 40 or 50 years is astronomical, isn't it? It all used to be government funded. It's now almost all industry funded. There's very little money actually going in for primary research. And unbiased research, much of it is basically the big sponsors, the big corporations calling the tune of what gets researched and what doesn't.
Well, they've become businesses in every meaningful sense. And, of course, we've seen the lecturers are going to be on strike this week or next week because, they see themselves as being an exploited workforce.
Well, back in beginning of October, I interviewed Dr. David Hughes from Lincoln University. He's one that put together this paper looking at potential problems in the vaccines. 26 different teams around the world that have photographed either the actual COVAX itself, or else people's blood and people's tissues that had been injected with these COVID vaccines, and found all sorts of peculiar shapes and sizes and things in there. But anyway, Dr. David Hughes had a lot to say when I talked to him about this whole idea of university funding and why it is that there are so few professors or doctors that speak out like he's done about the the problems with these COVID vaccines, because obviously they're thinking, well, crikey, you know, my job and my mortgage is rather more important to me than causing trouble in the media and getting bricks thrown at me for saying something I'm not supposed to.
When I was applying to universities back in early 80s time, there's something like 3 or 4 times the number of universities that there are now, and yet almost no academics saying the sort of things you're saying, David.
Yes, well, academia, like the media, has become very deeply embedded in neoliberal corporate capitalism. Many universities are run like businesses. Money and funding dictates virtually everything. So, for example, if you want to be promoted in academia and you're on a research path, then it's imperative to acquire research funding. That's one of the criteria. Well, that then means that you have to orient your research towards what the funders want to be researched. Now, I mean, your listeners are very welcome to get in touch with me and let me know if they know of any funders that would be willing to fund the kind of research that I do, looking into deep state criminality, looking into big lies, looking into what's actually in the vaccines. I mean, these are all fundamental questions on which questions of good and evil, human freedom, all rest. But who's going to fund them? And therefore, there's a strong tendency in academia to avoid looking at such questions. And what you find, actually, is that there's a tremendous level of groupthink in academia when it comes to some of this. So when I put out my 9/11 paper, which presented a substantial body of evidence indicating that the official 9/11 narrative is false, the immediate reaction by the academic community was a fierce Twitter storm in which dozens of academics from all parts of the world attacked me and said, this is conspiracy theorizing of the worst kind. They were posting up GIFs with a kind of a woman holding a pair of scissors, making a kind of stabbing motion, you know, really kind of visceral responses. They were claiming that the publisher should retract it, that the editor should, you know, hang their head in shame, and all of this kind of thing. I mean, it was really quite disgusting. Tim Haywood addressed it in an excellent piece on his blog called Peer Review or Trial by Twitter. It explains the whole saga. But the interesting point there is that if those dozens of academics were right, if my article were genuinely terrible and offensive, then they have an obligation to respond to it in the appropriate manner through an academic paper explaining what the flaws are, okay, and discrediting it in that way. Now, the simple fact is, here we are 2.5 years later, and despite the initial howls of outrage, academics have had absolutely nothing to say about my paper. It lays the most serious claims regarding 9/11, and academia has just remained silent. So I find this extremely sinister, and you know, I'm not holding my breath when it comes to academia actually investigating what's in these vaccines either. I mean, consider that in North America, for example, getting injected was a condition of being allowed on campus for many universities. Now, which North American university is then going to turn around, having pursued that kind of a policy, and say, well, oh yeah, okay, let's actually explore and investigate what's in these shots that we made everybody take? It's a bad situation.
It's almost like, I mean, it reminds me a bit of Nazi Germany, where the businesses were all around the country were all encouraged to be Nazified. In other words, to have big pictures of Adolf Hitler in there, swastikas all the way down the corridors and everything. The idea being that if you can implicate everybody in some crime, then it's much more difficult for them to do anything about it. And that seems to have happened here. Most amazing. Anyway, brilliant research. But look, I mean, this is dark. It's very, very difficult to... but many people just don't want to go there, David. And I noticed this is the but at the end. It's Americans are no shows for booster is an article on Politico today, where they're saying only something like 5% of the people who they would have expected to come for their booster jabs to get their COVID booster jabs have actually turned up. So maybe people, there is this almost sixth sense, or maybe some of this information is getting out to people where they're saying, well, actually, I'm just buying out of this whole thing now.
Yeah, we can't be all doom and gloom about it. Even the official data from the UK government shows that 18% of adults are unvaccinated, which might not sound like a lot, but the figure is almost certain to be higher than that because all of the official data gets massaged and manipulated. And I have heard from other sources, it's probably more like 25%. And even that, you might think, doesn't necessarily sound like a lot. But what seems clear is that whatever these vaccines are, whatever their true purpose is, they want everyone to take one. And Bill Gates said this back in April 2020, you know, we need to vaccinate the entire world. The WHO, the UN, the IMF, you know, these major global organizations have made similar pronouncements over the last 2.5 years. Now, if you have a quarter of the population that's withstood this kind of onslaught of military-grade propaganda and all of the kind of social shaming and everything else that went along with it, the pandemic of the unvaccinated and all this garbage. If a quarter of the population has stood up and said no, then that is a significant body of resistance, and it's hard to see how you can actually get that final 25% to take one of these things. Now, if you accept Matthias Desmet's suggestion that maybe something like 30% of the population is completely hypnotized and spellbound and believes everything that the television says. And then on the other hand, we have this 25% of absolutely firm resistors. What you have is a kind of mass in the middle, which can be led either way, really, could go either way. So if you look at it that way, it might be that we only need to win over maybe another 10 or 20% of the population to a more skeptical position. And these whole agendas become unenforceable because they all require our consent. They've tried to mislead us through lack of informed consent. But ultimately, it just takes enough people just to say no. And the whole thing ends. So I think that the situation is, in fact, much more finely poised than it might appear. On the other hand, I'm also convinced that the people at the top of the power pyramid who are ultimately responsible for all of this are psychopaths, that they are evil, and that they will go to any lengths to achieve their agenda. So they're by no means done with this. They're still trying to push forward the WHO pandemic treaty and so on. Bill Gates has warned repeatedly of the next pandemic. Joe Biden has told us that there will be a second pandemic. I mean, goodness knows what tricks they have up their sleeves next, but I think they will come again with this in one form or another. And one disturbing possibility is that the COVID so-called pandemic was used to condition populations psychologically so that they learn to accept certain responses, you know, putting on the masks, which incidentally were used at Guantanamo Bay as, you know, torture instruments on prisoners, you know, getting injections, accepting lockdowns, all this kind of thing. Now, as I say, COVID itself, despite what the propaganda says, even the UK government delisted it from being a high consequence infectious disease in March 2020. The thing that concerns me is what happens if they were to release some form of bioweapon, which is actually quite serious and does kill a lot more people. the kind of panic and fear that would then course through the population might then be enough to get the 75% to put enough pressure on the 25%. I don't know. I mean, these are just my fears, and hopefully it won't come to that. But I think that we're in a very finely balanced moment, and I think we're going to see some really world historical events in the coming years.
So that's Dr. David Hughes speaking to me about 6 weeks ago, and the full interview has been available for quite a long time. It's doing quite well on my BitChute channel. I think it's about 10,000 views or something. But anyway, it's quite shocking and amazing to see the photographs from around the world, from these 26 different teams of people who've been photographing things in the either in the jabs themselves, in the liquid that they're putting into you, or else in people's bodies, their tissues, their blood, after having been vaccinated. And a tremendous job he's done. But the point here, Martin, is that the universities are simply not capable of doing their job. They're far too in the pocket of the pharmaceutical industry.
Well, they're in the pocket of the pharmaceutical industry, they're in the pocket of the banks, they're in the pocket of the intelligence services. I mean, universities are a site of struggle. Some individuals like him, he's a university professor, are doing what they think is right, but they can easily be persecuted and can lose their careers, as we saw happen to David Miller here in Bristol, who was sacked by the university even though they did an internal disciplinary which found that it was no case to answer. So there we are. I mean, these things are going on. What should happen, as he points out there about 9/11, leaving aside the vaccine dispute, is if people didn't agree with his analysis of the 9/11 that Israel was involved, it was incumbent on them to write papers trashing his paper. But nobody dared to do it.
The amazing thing is some brilliant stuff is coming out. These fantastic documentaries are being produced, just not shown on the mainstream TV. They're scared of it. But anyway, one of the best is just, I mean, I think it is even maybe this week it's come out, maybe the last week, called Died Suddenly. And this looks at the links between what's been going on with COVID particularly, and eugenics, Martin. Now, this is something we have talked about quite a lot on here, isn't it? That the idea that there could be an aspect to this which is just simply to do with population reduction. As we know, there's quite a lot of elites out there that think that the world is overpopulated and we've got to do something about it.
Well, I mean, I don't think we've really got time to bash all of this out this evening, but we've talked about it a lot in the past. My view is that COVID itself is a biological warfare agent, and that's the view of Jeffrey Sachs, as it's been definitely leaked from a laboratory, and that issue is coming to the fore. The Kirillov, the Russian biological warfare chief, General Kirillov, has already accused the West of creating COVID, as have the Chinese. And I think and of course the vaccines, the mRNA vaccines produced by the Western pharmaceutical companies may well have all sorts of nasty stuff in them. But of course, nobody in China or Russia has had any of those vaccines.
I mean, I think one of the most amazing things to see is these actual pictures of people dying suddenly, say, for example, on television and on CCTV. And I noticed that the Alex Jones channel, I think it was Greg Rees on there, put that piece out. Actually, it wasn't done by them. And this is one of the problems with the Alex Jones and the David Icke style channels, is they quite often put out stuff as if it's their own, whereas actually it's been produced by somebody else. But what we're going to be looking at now is that I'll put a link up to the full documentary Died Suddenly on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, is this whole eugenics aspect, which is looked at in this latest documentary just out online and on our show page at thisweek.org.uk tonight.
U.S. life insurance companies have reported an overwhelming and unexplainable increase in all-cause deaths among 18 to 49-year-olds. Along with that, there's also been an increase in certain medical diagnoses such as miscarriages and Bell's palsy.
Well, when I first started seeing these strange anomalies in the blood, it's just there's something different about the blood. All of these people that were dying, doesn't matter what they died of, they were having this unique, there's this unique change in the blood. I feel as though I am seeing something that could be causing their death. No one will see what I see. So in the very beginning, I'm thinking, okay, so COVID could have caused this possibly, but now I'm seeing these in people that supposedly never had COVID, and then you find out they were vaccinated. And so it's like, okay, so it's the vaccine might be causing this.
I want people to understand that we're in a fifth generation warfare.
They now seek the news openly to manipulate and deceive the American population.
But you don't believe in any conspiracy theory?
Jane, what more can you tell us about the Sullivan Brothers building that's collapsed?
Leaf of science.
And we're injecting them in little kids' arms.
An 18-year-old health worker has developed blood clots after
controversial piece of Bigfoot.
Just days after getting their second COVID-19 vaccine, two teenage boys died in their sleep.
Oh, my God!
A 9-year-old went to sleep in Eagle Mountain and never woke up.
School cheerleader who died suddenly.
Who knows? Young people are dying these days.
You know, Matt and I are constantly talking about Malthusian theory.
Malthusian theory,
yes,
I know.
I'm sure you are.
It says it on one of the coffee cups I was given. You know, when I graduated, when I was at junior college, Chabot Junior College, we finished a history course, and the professor wrote up, you need to learn this word. He wrote up the word triage, which represented, I was told, the concept that eventually the world will have too many people in it in order to subsist on its own. And that stuck with me for a long time, and that's what Inferno is about. The quantum physics of overpopulation, in an instant, they could be too many people on the planet Earth, and actually the math does add up.
Just give us a 20-second definition of Malthusian theory, which
there
is
you
amazing.
Go. Well, that's what I'm built for.
I, Thomas Robert Malthus, have merely done you the service of stating the obvious, that the demographics of our situation equal death.
Reverend Thomas Robert Malthus was a British demographer of the late 1700s and was the first to popularize the idea that there's simply too many people using up too much resources.
How many cars, stereos, fancy bars?
How many people could the world support? Well, it depends. It's a sliding scale.
Malthusian ideology is often summarized in the following graph.
Very simple graphs which project what's going to happen to the planet over the next 150 years if we don't do something drastic to stop it.
It's an ideology, an eschatology.
Here we can see a chart that looks at the total world population over the last several hundred years. And at first glance, this is a bit scary.
And it spawned a new genre of fear that lasted for generations. The fear of overpopulation.
You have to get the death rate and birth rate in balance, and there's only two ways to do it. One is to bring the birth rate down, the other is to push the death rate up.
If we do not, by humane means, limit our numbers, then numbers are going to be limited by more famines and shortages.
It's reaching plague proportion.
No intelligent, patriotic American family ought to have more than two children, preferably one.
Maybe anybody who's thinking of having a third child ought to go hungry a week.
So should we have policies that penalize people for having extra kids in the developed world?
So I do think that we should at least consider it.
And this is where people start getting nervous talking about overpopulation and population issues, because they're scared that I'm going to take away their rights to have children.
It's the belief in a coming apocalypse, and that it is you and I who are ushering it in.
We're even running out of sand, which may not seem important, but without it you can't make concrete or glass, like for windows, so you can look outside and see the world ending.
Now, the world today has 6.8 billion people. That's headed up to about 9 billion.
Now, if we do a really great job on new vaccines, healthcare, reproductive health services, we could lower that by perhaps 10 or 15%.
Well, common sense would tell you if you have a man standing in front of you saying he's going to reduce the world's population by 10 or 15% using vaccines, what does that mean to you? It means somebody's going to die because you put a vaccine in them. It doesn't mean you're going to save people. That's pretty much common sense in my brain. But yet I saw him say it. He said it. And here we are. I don't know. I'm just, here we are. I'm now an anti-vaxxer. I wasn't before. From what I've learned here with this and seeing what I've seen, not just in the funeral home, but, you know, what everybody else has had an opportunity to see, I don't want to take any vaccine because I don't trust the pharmaceutical industry. I mean, I just buried someone recently who died suddenly. Wasn't sick. Person in their 60s, but otherwise was not sick. And I met with the family, and that was my first question, was what happened to him? Somebody mentioned to go onto Google and then type in died suddenly and find the news articles that would pop up.
So that's the extract from the film Died Suddenly. It's the beginning of it. Looking at the Malthusians, and I think absolutely brilliant, fantastic stuff. Not shown on our televisions. Come on, people. You know, this is what we need to see. And there's more of that. So I'll put that up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Well done to whoever's put that little thing together. And we'll be back after the break talking a bit more about local news here. The big news here in Bristol is they've got a clean air zone they're bringing in. Well, they call it a clean air zone. It's just a toll, really, because we've already got the clean enough air. Michael Bond and I did a little survey about 2 months ago looking at the council's own website, and their nitrogen dioxide levels are already below what the government say they've got to be. So they're just coining it. And also there's all sorts of other reasons we'll be looking at that anyway. That's the big story of the week here. Plus we'll be talking to Joe, who's with us at the moment, and we'll be talking to him about the Bristol Anarchy and some of the Bristol riots over the years after a break.
caught in every line. Marvin, Marvin, sang of the joy and pain. He opened up our mind, and I still can hear him say,
you found another home. I know you're not.
So we started with "The Day Thou Gavest Lord Is Ended." That was a choir of King's College, Cambridge. Then "The Night Shift," the Commodores, or otherwise known as Marvin. The song, that was from 1985. And "Sweet Little Lies." Actually, it's just called "Little Lies," from Fleetwood Mac in 1987. So, welcome back to Not the BCFM Politics Show. For those that want to bypass the psycho in the corner, on the new talkradio.org.uk stream and live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app, available free from all good app stores, not necessarily Google, with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. So we are going to start now by just having a look at some of the implications, hopefully, of the, and this is the big news in the, of the week here in Bristol, which is the introduction of this so-called clean air zone. And to kick us off, let's have a listen to ITV West, who've done well. I mean, they've been looking at this for quite a while, but they did a good piece earlier this week, just looking at some of the winners and losers. And the idea that there's a basic thing is that right around the city centre, and it is quite a wide zone, in including the ring road, which goes round the city centre, which seems completely insane. So how do you get round the clean air zone? Well, you have to go down little streets and rat runs in order to avoid it. People will be having to pay, the large vehicles, lorries, will be paying £100 a day to enter it, and car drivers £9 a day. So we're looking at anybody that has to, would normally be crossing somewhere in the city centre with a diesel vehicle that is not built within the last few years, will be paying something like £3,300 a year to do so, including small businesses and local residents. Ah, the idea, of course, is to keep the air clean, which is lovely. But the thing is that the council has done that anyway by shutting off so many of the roads in the city centre and closing them down, the dual carriageway or dual roads to single roads, and cutting massively down the amount of traffic that's able to get in and out of the city. So let's have a listen to ITV West now talking about this particular, what is going to be a big cost for a lot of people starting on Monday.
As businesses prepare for the introduction of Bristol's clean air zone on Monday, there are concerns traffic caused by the changes could impact traders in the city. From next week, the most polluting vehicles will be charged to enter the city centre. The zone goes to Templemead Station to the east and covers the Royal Infirmary to the north. It stretches up the A4 to the west and Bedminster Bridge roundabouts in the south. But there are those, however, who say the zone will help boost business and make Bristol more sustainable. Louisa Britton has been hearing from both sides of the debate.
For this company, which uses bicycles to deliver hundreds of parcels every day, the clean air zone was the reason they set up here, just on the outskirts of the boundary.
A non-compliant vehicle or a big HGV can come into our hub without entering the clean air zone, so they don't get that congestion or that clean air zone charge, as they can deliver directly into us. We can then de-van, offload and reload onto our super environmentally friendly, fast, clean bikes and trikes.
And bosses here are confident the scheme will help the business thrive.
In the last sort of like 4 or 5 months, we've had quite a few more inquiries from companies who are, you know, suddenly realising they've got to do something about their supply chain. So it definitely will have a positive impact for us, along with a positive impact for the environment.
Under the scheme, older, non-compliant cars will be charged £9 a day. Taxis will also pay £9, as will older, light goods vehicles. HGVs will pay £100, as will buses and coaches. Being on the outskirts of the zone does have its drawbacks, though. So says this catering business, which is based in Bedminster.
We potentially could be seeing an increase in traffic for our deliveries out to the centre of town, to places like the Old Vic and Bristol University, where we go every day for our drop and goes. So I think we could see, you know, increased times, durations, which could lead to higher costs for us.
The vans they use are compliant.
That's the last of it there.
As are 71% of vehicles in Bristol, according to the council. But that still leaves just shy of 30% having to find the extra money. That's the case for this homelessness charity, the van they use is just 1 year too old.
We might not be able to go into Tyne as often. We use the van once a week to transport our items for Outreach, but we also do give people lifts. We help people with moving furniture, collecting donations. So if each time we're going into town, say that could be, you know, a couple of times a day, if we're going to be charged the £9, that's going to add up throughout the month.
The zone won't just have an impact on the air above the city, but evidently on many of those living and working within it. Louisa Britton, ITV News.
So, yes, ITV looking at it. Now, we're also joined by Joe Banks. But first, Martin, what do you make of this? This is trying to clean up the air, apparently. But the main people it seems are going to be hit by this are small business owners with vans, including that those charity people we were hearing from there. £3,000-something pounds extra a year they've got to pay in order to really be operate in Bristol.
Well, as I've said before, I'm relatively agnostic about this. The arguments are on both sides are there. Any change of this sort is going to discomfort somebody. That's the problem with anything like
this. It doesn't discomfort the super rich who can buy their nice brand new Chelsea tractors and they won't be paying a penny.
No, perhaps not.
It's almost like we've got Tories running the city, isn't it?
No, well, ultimately, Tony, the decision to do this was based upon manifesto commitments by the mayor and in London, of course, Sadiq Khan. So if you don't like it, you've got to stand in the election and beat them. Otherwise, they're going to do it.
Well, that's not true. No, because in Leeds, for example, this was blocked because the Leeds people got together and they organised a legal challenge to it, saying, actually, the air quality is not bad enough for you to need this. And so they stopped it like that.
OK, well, if that's the case, then you can do it, can't you? But the question is it the case?
Anyway, what do you make, Joe? What do you make of this?
Well, I think I kind of agree with Martin. Cleaner air is a good idea. I have a concern that it leaves... When these schemes are badly managed and there is a sense that the least well-off and the disadvantaged are being penalised, that it leaves a political space for people like Nigel Farage, who's making movements and noises about this kind of stuff to move into. I had a sense of that in Bristol when they closed Bristol Bridge in during the lockdowns in 2020. And you saw a year later there was a Freedom of Information request from the Bristol Post that showed that the council had made around £3 million that year through fines and about 300 vehicles every day were getting fines. And you had very bad signage, you know, especially if you didn't know the city that well, you could easily just drive across. And that just instills this sense that it's a scam, you know?
Well, so there is enormous amount of financial pressure on the council, Martin, isn't there, just to make money from anywhere they can?
There is, and of course, underlying all of this is the austerity that local councils have been subjected to since.
But in which case,
2010.
It would be nice to see the mayor saying, "Actually, we've got to get money from anywhere we can, so that's why we're doing this." Whilst they're giving planning permission for these incinerators just upwind of us in Avonmouth, aren't they? Which don't actually do much for our clean air.
No, but what may also happen, as I said last week, is if we really do end up in a war with Russia before Christmas, which we might, there might be rationing of things like diesel, because it's actually a key thing for keeping infrastructure going across Europe. And we may be moving into an era where bellyaching about the clean air in Bristol is not the major issue, because everything isn't just about what goes on
it's
in Bristol.
A massive cost, though. I mean, for anybody, we heard about that charity just there, Joe. This is going to be costing them something like an extra between £3,000 and £3,500 a year just to operate as a charity, a homeless charity.
Yeah. There's also a suicide prevention charity that's been talking about, is now you know, trying to fundraise to support their activities.
I mean, it would seem obvious that certain groups like this, charities, shouldn't have to pay this because they're doing charitable work. The disabled shouldn't have to pay it. It seems incredible to me that taxi drivers are being told they have to pay it. Bus drivers. Now, these are all ways of getting people out of cars and off of, away from using cars, and yet they're still also included in the charge. I do wonder if people are actually going to pay it. We were discussing last week massive figures for Birmingham. Most people who've been charged in Birmingham simply haven't paid the charge. So we maybe because they can't, a lot of them just can't afford to. So they're saying, "Well, I'm just not going to pay it. I need to get from A to B," and they don't. They're kind of going outside the law, I suppose.
Yeah, well, we'll have to see how that happens. You know, especially in the current climate and through this very difficult winter.
There's also moves to increase the number of people who are being caught by council tax. Martin, the council tax when it very first started was controversial anyway, wasn't it? Because this is a tax on individuals who may have absolutely no money, whereas the previous rate system was a tax on the property owner and the property.
Well, that's right, and it was Margaret Thatcher who pushed through the poll tax or community charge, as it was then called. And, of course, it was modified as a result of her overthrow. But the basic principle of charging individuals for council services, hence council tax, was brought in. But, of course, in Northern Ireland, they knew very well that any attempt to introduce such a tax would be throwing petrol on the bonfire. So Northern Ireland still has the rating system that was originally brought in by Elizabeth I. And the middle class have always hated the rates. And Thatcher tapped into that and said, let's get rid of the rates and we'll charge the poor for their own services. Of course, that didn't work, but the modern council tax, and of course, it's based on valuations of houses dating back to the 1990s, it's massively regressive, and it's very difficult to collect, because very poor people who are in intermittent work, they're the ones who don't pay it, and they haven't got the money to pay it. So the council then spends a lot of time and energy chasing after people who can't actually pay anyway. And of course, it's all actually leads back to the idiocy of many of the policies pursued in the 1980s by the Tory government, including, we're talking about buses there earlier. Buses are going to be charged for coming into the zone. The buses should belong to the council. And therefore, they wouldn't need to be. I mean, it's because they're privately run and privately owned that they're being charged. At the same time, the council is subsidising, or they're reducing the subsidy on some of the routes which First Bus uses. And now, if you're going to subsidise something, there's little point having it in the private sector at all. But of course, we can't state the obvious. In other parts of the world, buses are not run like that. It's only here.
Yeah, it just seems to me that the council's now being run a bit like a business, and they're looking at opportunities for make money out of the fact that they own and control much of the city, the roads, etc.
I'm giving planning permission as well, because the business rate is going to be given back to the councils. So they've got a vested interest in giving way to property developers and so on. This is what this is all about. And the whole thing of bringing the mayoral system in, it makes me laugh, because the councils have got less and less actual power at the same time as we're arguing over what figurehead we're going to have on it. And, of course, the austerity that Jeremy Hunt is proposing is going to fall massively on local councils who haven't got enough money for social care or for special needs. And therefore, they then think, well, we've got to be entrepreneurial. We've got to make money some other way.
Anyway, let's hear from the sheriff of the sheriff of Bristol. No, it's Marvin Rees, our wonderful, marvellous Marvin, the mayor, and as to how his city is tackling the climate crisis. So he sees this as a great way of sort of contributing to some massive effort around the world to stop the destruction of civilization, of mankind, of species, etc. And this is why he's doing it, apparently. And this controversial TED talk that he did, a little extract from that, over in Vancouver, Canada, which he then decided that one of our local democracy reporters was no longer welcome coming to his press conferences, because he asked him an awkward question: do you think it's a good idea for you to fly across the world to talk about saving the climate, and when you could have done it on Zoom? And then the rest of when this guy was told Alex Seabrook, I think is his name, that he wasn't no longer welcome coming to the mayor's press conferences. It was great to see actually the rest of the Bristol media, Bristol 24/7, the Bristol Post, ITV, and the BBC all boycotting the mayor's press conferences. And then, as a reaction to that, the mayor's press office decided they were not going to send press releases to those organisations anymore. They were just going to do their own news through their own news website. So, yeah, I mean, basically behaving exactly like a big corporation, thinking that they can completely control the way that they're discussed. And that's our wonderful council for you. And here's our wonderful mayor over in Vancouver talking about the background to why he's doing this kind of thing.
Cities are responsible for around 75% of CO2 emissions, and we're also prodigious emitters of nitrogen dioxide and methane. And cities consume 80% of the world's energy. But think about this, that it's the characteristics of cities, their reach, their size, their density, close proximity of the leadership to the people, their adaptability, and their capacity for reinvention, that mean that we can actually plan to manage those numbers. That means through our cities, we can actually plan to do more for more people with less. And it's why I say cities are one of the most effective tools we have at our disposal for leveraging efficiency into our relationships with land, energy, and waste. Through our cities, we can increase the efficiency of more human lives more quickly than through any other form of human organization. So we can, for example, house and employ more people on less land, minimizing the pressure on urban sprawl, which competes then for land for nature, while minimizing the distances people have to travel to meet their basic needs. Through cities, we can have people sharing energy by sharing buildings and through smart innovations like heat networks. The density in our cities makes public transport more accessible and more cost-effective. And through our cities, we can transform our relationship with energy. We need energy security right now, but cities offer markets of such scale that they make investing in renewables more financially attractive.
Well, that's part of Marvin Rees's Bristol Mayor's TED Talk he did a few months ago over in Vancouver. The first thing I point out there, Martin, is public transport he's talking about. Actually, public transport in Bristol is collapsing. We've just been told 1,200 less bus journeys a month will be taking place. They're shutting down routes.
Well, I mean, all of that was aspirational, wasn't it? I mean, it's very broad brush visioning there.
Well, he's also talking about the mass transit network as well, which he's been talking about for the last 8 years. Nothing's happened at all. He's talking about an underground and this sort of thing. It's all just, it seems to me, fantasy.
Well, the reality is that much worse things are coming down the pike than people realise. And that's how I see it anyway.
I even remember Marvin talking about speedboat racing on the floating harbour when he first arrived.
That's right,
none of this has happened.
No, none of it's happened. And I think the other thing is that because of the kind of personality focus of having mayors, and of course we're going to get rid of having mayors, they feel that they've got to make a mark in terms of solving the problems. My big beef with Marvin is when he was first elected, he needed to turn around to the core Labour voters and say, the truth is, I can't do much here. My hands are tied. And I will do what we can to try and protect the services that we all depend on and all the rest of it. But don't expect miracles.
What he's actually seems to be doing, Martin, I know exactly what you're saying. He seems to be kind of smoothing over the cuts that the Tories in Westminster are doing.
Well, it struck me as odd when he said we've got to do more with less. Now, I suppose what he means by that, we've got to become more energy efficient. But the idea that we've got to accept the deal and then we've got to work within that deal. In the 1980s, of course, Liverpool City Council and Lambeth Council, where I was living at the time, refused to set a rate because they felt we're not going to cut any of our services, so they refused to set a rate. Of course, that then collapsed and they couldn't sustain it. And nobody in the Labour Party now talks in those terms of councils, because it goes back to Poplar Council in the 1900s refusing to set a rate and being sent to prison and so on. So it's a sort of civil disobedience protest. But if you do have to accept that you can't do that, you don't have to take, but we're going to improve things. Bristol will be better. Bristol won't be better until you change national policy. Everything isn't decided at local level.
Well, I mean,
it'd
be nice to hear that from the mayor, wouldn't it? Anyway, yeah, Joe, what do you make of Marvin's sort of vision there, I suppose it is, of, you know, a city where energy, we're much more, he's kept using the word efficiency. We've got to become much more energy efficient. He's kind of saying obvious stuff, that you can get more people in, you can cram more people in, and that kind of relieves the pressure on parkland and land on the fringes of the city. He seems to be really talking about building up, which is what's going on here, isn't it?
Yeah, that's it.
We've got lots of... We keep hearing this phrase from Marvin, which is cranes on the horizon, which is the sort of phrase you hear from property speculators and developers, which is, it's got to be a good thing.
Yeah.
But, I mean, it's good to build stuff.
There's
but
a logic to it.
Yeah, go on.
You know, that people are closer to where they work in a centre. They don't have to travel by car from the outskirts, and you're not building on the greenbelt. But the way it seems to actually work out in reality is that you're building very ugly high-rise buildings in the centre that aren't actually going to meet the real housing demand. You know, those 16,000 people who are on the council waiting list are not going to be helped by, you know, expensive flats in the centre of Bristol, and, you know, high-rise flats.
Yeah, there is this sort of anomaly. We often get politicians talking about, yeah, we're building houses. Marvin particularly says this. Those houses are completely out of the reach of most of the people, certainly any of them, that are on that homeless list.
Yeah. And following on from Martin, the thing about transport, you know, the bizarre thing in Bristol is that... you know, Marvin Rees doesn't control transport. That's a Wecker issue. That's the West of England mayor, which is another complexity to the situation.
Also, we hear this week that thousands of Bristol poorest families could be forced to pay council tax for the first time in years. About 18,000 of Bristol's poorest households could be forced to sacrifice some of their benefits to pay towards council tax for the first time in years because of the local authority's funding crisis. Bristol City Council is proposing to cut £3 million from its council tax reduction scheme as part of a range of cost-cutting measures to meet a huge financial shortfall, partly of which is the mayor's fault for pouring something like £40 million down the drain after Bristol Energy. It means the 18,000 families who currently pay nothing could be asked to contribute 10 or 20% from April 2024 under plans put forward reluctantly, by the Labour administration. A further 5,000 working-age adults claim a discount based on income and benefit allowances. So, I mean, I'll get you both comments from both of you on this, because this is amazing, isn't it? So people who are actually on benefits, what they're now saying is, well, sorry, you're not on benefits anymore. Those benefits are going to just go to pay your council tax. Joe, this is going to be devastating for a lot of people. Well, 18,000, they're saying here.
Yeah, it is. I mean, and this is something that they, you know, to give them credit, this administration seems to have done pretty well on it, and made an important feature of what they're doing was you know, cutting out council tax for a lot of people for the poorest people. There seems to be a mix of things going on. I mean, that all councils are facing the same difficulties, in a sense.
Basically, people are just going to have to default on this, aren't they? Most of these people, they're just about managing to survive, particularly, you know, pensioners are going to be having to... this is going to be being clawed back from their pensions. 13,000 pensioners in the city receive support to reduce or cover their bills, which is not under threat because of government policy, although this has to be paid out of council coffers. This is £13 million this year out of the scheme's £42 million. £1 million total costs. Bristol's the only major city to have kept the full reduction in place. The authority is proposing £45.7 million of cuts to services in its annual budget. So this is, I mean, really, it's central government again, Martin, isn't it, behind this? But the mayor doesn't really seem to point the finger at Westminster very much. And it looks as if people are just going to simply, I don't know, what will happen? Will people go to prison because they can't pay this money? I mean, it seems pointless taxing people who just don't have any money and are on benefits. Surely, there are other people in the city who do have money. If you want to take money off them, those are the ones to do it from, the big property owners, for example.
Yes, which is what the rating system used to do, which is why Thatcher abolished it, except in Northern Ireland where it would have, intensified the civil war. I used to work for Bristol Debt Advice Centre. It's called something else now. It's called Talking Money. I did a bit of research for them some years ago, many years ago now. But we were looking at council tax. Council tax is a very, very regressive tax. The people who end up not being able to pay are people on very low incomes and even people on benefits. It's only because the council made the decision to cut them out.
It seems to me that people are being deliberately driven into debt.
Yes. Now, I've actually been affected by this because I get a universal credit payment, and because I wasn't paid by my current employer for a month and they delayed the pay and I got a double payment, this is about 12 months ago, they therefore then came back to me and said, "Oh, you're earning too much for us to give you a top up of your, a reduction in council tax." So I've been put on paying full council tax, whereas previously
just for that 1 month?
Yeah, because it was the hump. Now, what they're trying to do here is they are deciding, having had a policy of not charging people on low incomes full council tax, they've rescinded that. But, of course, as pointed out, everywhere else in the country never had that option, or that option wasn't pursued. People on benefits shouldn't be paying taxes at all, should they? It doesn't make any sense to do that. But then that is the system we live in. And the money that I get from Universal Credit, I don't see any of that. That goes to my buy-to-let landlords, who are Tory farmers, and they get the subsidy. That's where the money goes.
Anyway, so it's there's a silly setup, obviously a lots of problems chugging down the track for the poorest end of the Bristolians, who probably voted for Marvin Rees, thinking a Labour mayor might do something for them. And as a result, we've just had the annual State of the City address recently, which is something that Marvin Rees and George Ferguson have been doing. Big kind of lot of pomp and whatever around it. It's usually about half an hour long, where it's the mayor spelling out their vision for the city. And I noticed as part of this, there was something kind of bizarre, saying, well, we know everyone is getting into fuel poverty problems. Haven't got enough money to buy food. You haven't got enough money to heat your homes anymore. So it's becoming like a third world country. And so let's make sure we've got these things called welcoming spaces being opened across the city to help people who are feeling depressed or cold or hungry.
But I actually want to start with a promise to Bristol, which is rooted in the moment in which we find ourselves. And it's this, that we will do our best to support the city through this national cost of living crisis. I have to be frank, I do not pretend that we'll be able to hold off all the hardship that we are going to be facing. But I do believe that the work we've done over the last 6 years to build affordable homes, extend the living wage, tackle hunger, has been a real investment in the individual and community resilience we are really going to need. And the work we've done over the last 6 months with partners to set up a network of welcoming spaces in communities right across Bristol will also offer real immediate support. And if you don't know, these welcoming spaces are community venues that people can go to. They can hang out, they can access Wi-Fi, they can be warm. And if needed, they can access support and advice on anything from finance to emotional well-being, mental health, employment and skills. And I also want to take the occasion just to thank the benefactor who put a considerable sum of money forward to support welcoming places. They've asked to remain anonymous, but I just want to publicly say thank you. But I can't emphasise just how challenging the coming months will continue to be, not least because this cost of living crisis is being mirrored by a cost of operating crisis that's being faced by the public and voluntary community sector organisations who are most relied on in times like these.
Yeah, so fascinating, I thought there. An anonymous donor has given the council millions of pounds or hundreds of thousands of pounds in order for them to set up these little centres around the city, Martin, and to so people can go and be warm in there when their houses are freezing.
Well, this is the sort of thing that ought to be paid for by taxation, shouldn't it? Mm. Yeah. So what we're moving towards is a philanthropist society where the wealthy voluntarily give their wealth to help others because they don't pay any taxes. Back in the 1950s, the top rate of tax in this country was 95%. And in 1979, when Thatcher took power, it was 85%. We're now arguing whether it should be 40% or 45%. And then we wonder why we haven't got any money for anything. Now, in fact, it wasn't a disaster to have a 95% top rate of tax and a massive inheritance tax, of course, which is why the National Trust ended up owning all of these properties, because they couldn't afford the death duties. It was a more robust era. The boys were dying on the front line in Korea at the Battle of the Indian River. People were losing their sons to a war against communism and China. And, of course, that meant that the wealthy had to pay their way. But that all went out the window in 1979, didn't it?
So, Joe, what do you make of this?
Commendable in a way, but disturbing in its normalisation of this kind of intervention, like food banks.
Is it okay for someone to just anonymously donate a load of money to the council?
That is quite weird, isn't it? Yeah.
That to me sounds very bizarre. Whoever it is, is it the Merchant Venturers? Is it King Charles? You know, who is it? Someone that wants to keep their identity hidden because they're such a nice person.
Did you remember some years ago there was a woman who'd worked as a nurse in the health service for years, and she lived in a council house in Bristol, and it turned out she got nearly £1 million in savings, and she was a single person, and she left the money to the government of the day in order to, you know,
I think
do
to the NHS, wasn't it?
No, to the government of the day.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, one of the things about Captain Tom and his great, you know, money for the NHS thing, and, of course, his charity has now got mired in all sorts of questions, not as much as Baroness Moan and her PPA scam, but when Captain Tom was marching up and down his stairs for charity, he's not allowed to give that directly to the NHS. It goes to NHS charities, because if it was given directly to the NHS, the government of the day could just cut the budget by the 10 million that he's donated. And that's the problem with this. And that's why there's actually a rule that you can't donate directly to the NHS like that, so that the government of the day can't then use that money to get out of its own responsibility to fund it properly.
Mm-hmm. So anyway, Joe, this seems like the council's solution. Welcoming spaces. People have got no money to, not enough money to feed children or themselves. They're having to go to food banks. They haven't got enough money to heat their home. We've now got these wonderful things called welcoming spaces springing up around the city to save the day.
Yeah, it's a symptom of a symptom of a broken system. Another thing I was going to say about the council cuts is that in some areas, there seems to me a sense that the crisis is seen as an opportunity. And you can look, if you look at something like what's been proposed in city design, which might sound, you know, far less important than these sort of bread and butter issues of survival. What's proposed for that department, which works with planning officers to its specialists working on placemaking and urban design, and giving advice to the planning department, there's a massive restructuring proposed there that would see what I've been told 30% redundancies and outsourcing. So that you're basically getting rid of council staff and going to consultants who are then, you know, basically paid to tell you what you want to hear. which is very troubling, I think.
Well, are you talking about planning consultants? Or what sort of consultants? Yeah, because most of these planning consultants work for the speculators, work for the developers. I mean, that's what they're generally to get you your planning permission.
Yeah, and they'll give you, if you want, as a planning department, you want certain advice and you like what they're saying, you're more likely to employ them again in the future. They're more likely to tell you what you want to hear, unlike, you know, people on the council payroll who have a job to do. And they'll tell you whether that's advice in terms of conservation or heritage or whatever transport system.
Martin, it sounds to me like the council's just been privatised.
Yeah, well, and this is the shock doctrine, isn't it? As we go forward, there's one shock after another for the health service, for local councils, whatever, and then they bring in all this other stuff on the back of it. So it's a very dangerous time for that very reason. And Europe is going to get, we've been told by the Bank of England, the Office of Budget Responsibility, etc., the Institute for Fiscal Studies, we're going to have a 2-year recession minimum. And I suggest to you that once you get into a recession, it could easily turn into a depression like the 1930s, deflation, not inflation. And I think that's the real danger, actually, is deflation rather than inflation. The inflation is used as a mechanism to bring the deflation in, which is what the big boys really want. And then they're going to buy everything up for a song and all the rest of it. And, you know, these are challenging times, not just in Bristol, across the world, but particularly in Western Europe.
We're focusing on Bristol today. Bristol Central Library could move to the former Debenhams building, say council chiefs. The library's budget has been slashed by a third. Now, we've had battles, Joe, over the last decade, really, to save the libraries. Now, it looks like the Central Library's under threat, and the budget for all the other libraries in the city is also being slashed again. Labour Cabinet Member for Public Health and Communities, Councillor Ellie King, told a budget scrutiny meeting on Tuesday, the 22nd of November, "This hurts, and this hurts everyone. This is not a happy place to be in at all. But this is where we are." That's the sort of rhetoric we're getting from. She says, "I get it that it's a much-loved, beautiful building. It's part of our heritage, very important to a lot of people. However, there are opportunities to support this council by moving the service. What if we moved into the lower ground floor of this building, City Hall? You can't say that would get a different footfall because it's only a few metres away. It would be free to use. What if we moved it to Broadmead, to the ground floor of Debenhams? Imagine the footfall you would get there that's different to the ones you get here. Because I know the people that shop around here and the people who shop around here, and I'm interested in getting the kids who shop around there into libraries." So what do you make of this? I mean, it does sound as if she's kind of just making this up as she goes along and saying, you know, well, if we put it there, then we might get different people coming past it. But actually, we've got a purpose-built central library that's been there for hundreds of years.
Yeah, no, I think it's appalling, and it's a sense of there are people there who know the price of everything and the value of nothing, and you know, to have a civic building at the centre of the city that's free for everyone, you know, says something about who we are and the kind of the city we want to be. And that's the idea that you were tuckered away in the ground floor of Debenhams is disgraceful to me. And I think there will be a big reaction to that, and a you know, a strong movement to save the library. But there is also an issue, I think, they've already let out a couple of floors to the cathedral school there, so that people are talking about, well, you know, that whether this is the school wanting to take over the building.
I mean, it doesn't sound like they really like the idea of libraries at all, Martin. I mean, do you think libraries are in kind of history now?
Well, obviously, if they're looking to cut things, they've got to cut something, and therefore libraries are in the firing line. I would argue that in actual fact there should be public investment across the country in all sorts of things, and that's the way to save
the
economy.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because all this QE money is just going into propping up share prices and asset prices. It surely could be just going in to keep libraries open. What's the problem?
You could do all sorts of things.
This is a central government.
You could do all sorts of things, but at local level, you can't. Right, unless you defy the law, in which case it then doesn't work, as we found in the 1980s. So it's a very difficult situation. Now, in the case of the Central Library, which I use a lot, it is the case that the Cathedral School took it over. I actually worked for a while at the Cathedral School in the new building in the school downstairs. And, of course, it's not actually suitable for a primary school because they've got no play space. Yeah, they have to cross a road to play in an area, but the point about having a cathedral school, which is an academy trust, the cathedral school, the secondary school is still a private fee-paying school, but they set up the cathedral primary school, just like Colston Girls' School, which is now Montpellier High School, was a private school, but they went into the state system in 2008, and the cathedral school are diversifying into the state system. But because people have got kids in the secondary school, they get preferential treatment for the Christine Townsend covered a lot of this. They get preferential treatment because if you've got a brother or sister in the school, you're more likely to be allowed to go there. So in other words, that skews the intake of the cathedral school, and it's got a massive catchment area which extends out to South Gloss. Now, in actual fact, there was no demand for primary places in that ward. Yeah, there are already schools which provide the local kids with primary education. But this is a new thing, and it's Academy Trust. You said, so the local council doesn't control it, but they had enough clout with the council, and Marvin went along and cut the ribbon when the school was opened. And so there they are, having taken over half of the library space, and Christine Townsend was actually very involved in the campaign to stop that happening. And as I would say, I would agree with that, because it's not a suitable building for a primary school, for all kinds of reasons. And I think quite likely they do want to take over the top bit. And, of course, ultimately the cathedral school, secondary school, I think they're looking to go into the state system and all the rest of it. But it's...
They've obviously got people who want to use that space. Sorry, we don't want the library here. We've got more important things to do.
Yeah, well, I mean, they're empire building on their little plot there.
So there's this. I suppose the other thing that's going on in the city at the same time, Joe, is the getting rid of the zoo too. So the idea that the zoo's gone and the luxury flats being built on there. Now, I mean, all of these things are just basic good public amenities, places where people can enjoy themselves, kids can go out for the day. I mean, a library and a zoo both gone pretty much in. Well, it's not the library hasn't gone yet. They're now talking about getting rid of it, and many of the other libraries. It seems like a lot of the kind of cultural infrastructure of the city is going into the rubbish bin.
Yeah, and cuts to the parks. Big cuts to the parks they're talking about, and the suggestion I've seen is that community groups take over the running of the park somehow, but it's that wasn't very clear. And it was a good point. It's a good point that Jeff Gollop made, who's been on this show, who was chairing that extraordinary scrutiny meeting the last couple of days, was that so they've come out with all this material about a consultation on the cuts, but in every area they're just saying the amount of money that's cut rather than giving a percentage, so that you've got some sense of how that's going to impact the service.
I mean, if you can't just dismantle the city's cultural infrastructure, Martin, without causing problems, can you?
Well, these are one of the problems that we're facing. Jeff Gollop is an interesting character because, of course, he heads up the Tory group on the council. Mm. And in the past, he's...
I think actually Mark Weston is...
No, Mark Weston's the leader, isn't he? He does quite a good job of holding the council to account about things like that. And he's actually quite a middle-of-the-road Tory as well. He's not the sort of person who's in favour of cuts per se. But nevertheless, he's part of a party which has had a policy of denuding local authorities of resources going back to the 1980s. Yeah. That's been your policy. And what Marvin should have done with Jeff Gollop campaigned to keep his library open up in Westbury, or think wherever he's... And what I would have done if I was Marvin is say, we're going to have to cut the libraries, so we're going to cut them in the Tory wards, because you said you wanted cuts.
I don't think
that's where the cuts are going to be.
There's no political intelligence like this from the Labour Party for some reason.
That's the obvious thing to say to them, isn't it?
It's the obvious thing to do, yeah. I mean, we've got this, as we were talking about, these welcoming spaces opening up. Well, there's another possibility. As the people get cold over the winter, they're getting these demands for council tax when they don't have any money, and the poor are being hit the hardest in a city which voted the opposite, which is Labour. There may be people actually getting upset about this, coming out onto the streets, civil disobedience, this sort of thing, riots even. And I mean, because that's what I think the mayor, Marvin Rees, has got a vision for this welcoming spaces. He hopes that's going to sort things out. Maybe it's going to be a little bit more in your face, Joe.
It might be, yeah. Riots tend to happen in the summer, don't they? So maybe next summer we'll see things bubble up.
Now, we've got a history of rioting in Bristol. This is what I'm coming around to talking about now. We're going to be hearing from you about the anarchy, which is a medieval thing. We've got 10 great Bristol riots, or terrible Bristol riots, you might say. 1793, the Bristol... Do you want to... I mean, I don't know how much you know about these, but do you want to talk a little bit about each of them as I reel them off?
Well, I mean, I don't have a huge amount of knowledge about the riot, but sort of the anarchy...
Talk about that first thing, because that's before this, isn't it?
So, I mean, we're talking about parks. I've been talking about Castle Park to you before, and St. James's Priory, which is the oldest building in Bristol, founded in 1129, tucked away behind the bus station opposite Broadmead. And so this is that world of the 12th century, where you had a civil war. You had a breakdown of royal authority, basically, after Henry I died. 1135, and this was connected to a succession crisis because his eldest, his only legitimate male heir, had died in a ship disaster back in 1120, and this led on to a period of almost two decades where you had the barons, you know, basically you had, you know, psychopathic barons, warlords, basically a world of warlords fighting each other for power, you know, and yeah, so I mean, this wasn't a period of kind of popular riot.
I mean, just think about the feudal system that was operating at the time, where you had where the king would do basically was to dish out land to various gentry, aristocrats, and say, well, I mean, I don't know, maybe that's a later term to use for them, but it was a pretty much a strict hierarchy. Like, this friend of mine is in charge of one county, another friend another county, a Duke of Sussex, Duke of, you know, wherever. And once the royal authority is gone, for whatever reason, then, of course, these lot kind of factionalise and then start to battle for control.
Yeah. And that's what happened when Henry died in 1135. He had wanted his daughter Matilda to become, to take over, but the barons, you know, were wary of a woman coming to the throne, and so Henry's nephew Stephen slipped over the channel, because that Anglo-Norman world was obviously England and Northern France. He came over the channel and, aided by his brother, Henry of Blois, who was the Bishop of Winchester, a very kind of worldly, corrupt ecclesiastical figure, and took the throne in 1135, but, you know, didn't wasn't able to dominate the barons in the way Henry I was. So you had these constant rebellions he was trying to suppress. And then Matilda, supported by her main military backer, who was Robert Earl of Gloucester, the man who built Bristol Castle, built St. James's Priory, they come back over in the late 1130s to try and take the throne. And then you have this long period of civil war between the two main parties, the Angevin cause in the west of England, centred on Bristol, as Bristol is the stronghold, and then Stephen in London in the southeast. And there's a great quote from the Peterborough Chronicle, which talks about, I've got it somewhere. Never before had there been greater wretchedness in the country, and they said openly that Christ and his saints slept.
Well, it sounds a little bit like an earlier version of the Wars of the Roses up north. If you've got this kind of east-west divide in the south, people battling for control, we had something very similar, didn't we, a couple of hundred years later?
Well, this period that sees the start of the Plantagenets, because ultimately that's Henry II, who is the son of Matilda. And then you have a period for 331 years where it's the Plantagenets on the English throne up until the Wars of the Roses. So in a sense, it is Bristol's strategic importance that secures the Plantagenet dynasty that then rules England for 331 years.
Now, I think there has always been this sort of rivalry, even today, between Bristol in the west, the two ends of the Brunel's railway line, and London in the east. The Bristolians think they can do it better than the Londoners. The Londoners think they can do it better than the Bristolians. Yeah. We've also got our little powerhouse, the Merchant Venturers here, that was set up in medieval times to control the trade in the city. It's like kind of the merchants that ran the city, that owned the city, that the city was run in their interests.
This all really starts in this period, because it's through Henry II. So Henry II is actually educated in Bristol. In 1142, he comes to Bristol Castle because it's his uncle, Robert, who controls Bristol, controls huge swathes of the west of England, and he's educated here. And then he has lots of connections to Bristol and a fondness for Bristol, I think. And it's when he becomes king that you get the wine trade with Gascony, because he, through his marriage to Eleanor of Aquitaine, part of his kingdom is his whole swathe down the west of France. And so that's when the wine trade starts. You know, the wine trade becomes the main driving force for the Bristol economy in that later medieval period.
Okay, so how did it pan out the other door? I mean, basically London won, didn't it? Eventually, London became the centre for trade. Actually, Bristol is very different. I mean, London's got much more of a capacity as a port, but Bristol was, I suppose, a military port, better defended because of the natural gorge between us and the Bristol Channel. I suppose at some point it may have been that Bristol could have become the capital of the UK or the capital of England.
Yeah, well, even back in the 12th century, it was one of those second tier cities. So you had London and Winchester were the main urban centres, and then already, even though Bristol only started in the late Saxon period, you had it was along with Norwich, York, and Lincoln, one of the most significant centres.
I suppose we weren't quite close enough to the continent, really, to win out against the Londoners.
Yeah, I guess the Thames is, yeah.
Okay, so how did this affect this? I mean, you're talking about the anarchy. What do you mean by that? That was just the period.
Well, that was the term given to that period in the night by 19th century historians, because it was this breakdown of order, and then ultimately Henry II comes. Well, what happens is that everyone's exhausted by these years and continual fighting, and the fighting is often based on sieges. There aren't many big battles, but it's people in castles, and then you're surrounded, and these sieges go on for months, and it's often a kind of stalemate. But ultimately, Stephen's son dies, who may have inherited the throne, and he basically agrees to hand it on to Henry, who's this up-and-coming, thrusting figure who's now coming over the channel and attacking him and is the coming force. And then Henry II's whole reign is based on restoring the order of his grandfather, Henry I.
I suppose in those days, everyone kind of knew who was in charge. It was quite a strict hierarchy. Nowadays, it's a bit like where we've got this kind of deep state. They're kind of hidden behind the veil. A very different world to in the medieval times, and people knew who they were following. They knew who was in charge. It's one of those sad things about losing Jeremy Paxman off of the BBC. It's a question every few weeks he would pop up. Yeah, but who's in charge? That was much clearer in those days, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, it was clear because your village was burned down, and you knew who was in charge, because it was a very brutal world, and this was mainly a struggle between elites, but the peasants who are working the land were just collateral damage, and you would try and knock out your rival's economic base, and that was the crops, and that was the people working the fields.
Well, hey, your rival's economic base is being knocked out, folks. You're being driven into debt today. You, the elite, you are their rivals. Just to run through the list of riots, because I think it's quite a nice little thing to pull together, actually. Thanks for doing so, which is 1793, the Bristol Bridge riots. That Bristol Bridge we were talking about earlier being closed off now, it's the reason that Bristol's here, that bridge. Now people, if they drive across it, they're trapped, and they're sent a little letter sent a little letter in the post, here's £120 fine or whatever for driving across our bridge. I thought we had a civil war to get rid of these tolls. Fought that with Oliver Cromwell, etc., and afterwards they didn't have the tolls anymore. But anyway, and also then there was the 1809 New Cut riot.
That was more a massive drunken brawl. That one.
Ah.
That was the workers who were digging the New Cut, and they had a celebration at the end of it.
Oh wow!
And everyone got off their faces, and it was the Irish workers against the English, and they had a big punch up.
The Queen's Square riots. Now these are, in fact, you can, if you go to the City Art Gallery here, get a postcard of the burning of Queen's Square. So what was behind that?
Martin may know more than me, but this was about the Reform Act not going through Parliament, which was going to extend the franchise into, particularly to the new industrial cities. And it was brutally put down in Bristol. Many people were executed.
Well, it's things are different today. It's almost like your vote doesn't really mean anything. Everyone's got the vote, but it doesn't actually change any very much. Martin, you got anything to say about that?
There's a long history of armed rebellion in Bristol, rioting and so on. It was the second city of the country. London's got a similar history, so it's not that surprising. This is where things happened. So the Kingswood miners used to march down into Bristol in the 17th century and demand various things. So, and then of course they used to march down the hill, and the property classes would be freaking out when they arrived in the centre of town.
Here comes the communists.
Well, they weren't communists.
Well, I know.
This was about tolls because they used to, the coal was dug up at Kingswood and then carried down into the town, but they put up tolls to stop to try and make money off it.
People can get very angry about tolls, especially when they're called clean air zones.
Well, anyway, but the 1834 was it 1834?
31
riot was very interesting because it was on the back of agitation. So there was lots of agitation in urban areas, including Bristol, about trying to extend the franchise. And it wouldn't have been extended very far. I mean, the Act was passed in 1834, I think, and it just gave slightly less wealthy people a vote, but it was still a tiny minority of the population, but it was opening the system up. That's how it was perceived at the time. And, of course, the French Revolution had happened, so there was a great deal of resistance from the property classes to allowing anybody else to have a say, because it was regarded as, well, where are we going to end up? It's going to be like France. So, anyway, there was quite a lot of radical agitation here in Bristol. And some big knob from London came down in his carriage, and that allowed the agitators to start throwing stones at his carriage. I can't remember all the details. People can look all this up online. And that started the riot. And in those days, of course, there was no police force as such to deal with a riot. Yeah, there were local constables, but they were very like part-time coppers now. They weren't permanently employed, or if they were...
No one was following their mobile phones.
No. And there was also the militia. Yeah, and if you remember at Peterloo in 1819, the local militia on horses, you know, basically the local shop owners and wealthy people, they were the people who killed the people on St. Peter's Fields in Manchester. So this was later than that, so there was a potential for that to happen. And the guy was actually in charge of the militia here in Bristol because he sympathised with the goals of the rioters, and also because of what had happened in Manchester. He didn't go in and put it down.
Did they not? I thought they went into Queen Square.
They did go into Queen Square, yeah. But he could have stopped it. But he was subsequently put on trial for not putting it down, and he actually committed suicide, shot himself.
Oh, really?
As a result of all of this, because he was put in a very impossible position. He was sympathetic.
Somebody who did take an active role was Brunel, who signed up as a special constable.
Yes, indeed. So, in other words, the property classes were pretty freaked out. And they were pretty freaked out because, in actual fact, it was a very uncontrolled riot. It started off as a riot about, you know, we want more democracy, inverted commas. But it turned into... They broke open the prison. Yeah? So they broke into the prison and let everybody out of the prison.
Once you've done that,
and the militia, led by this guy, Colonel Beresford, something his name was, I think, he didn't intervene, and so the whole thing just snowballed out of control very quickly. Mm-hmm. And they burned down all of the houses around Queen Square, all the posh houses. They sacked the cathedral, and all the rest of it.
Martin is grinning, as he's
saying. Delight in his face.
Grinning with delight. Well, I mean, it's not really delight. In actual fact, what happened was nearly 200 people died. But they were mostly rioters killed by other rioters by accident. So the looters were trying to loot Green Square, but the arsonists were trying to burn it down. And because they were throwing petrol bombs and stuff to try and burn everything down, the people who were looting all got burned to death.
Yeah, they didn't have their ducks in a row quite there, did they?
Well, exactly. So in other words, the sort of anarchist movement in Bristol likes to think of this as some kind of great festival of the oppressed.
Well,
it was actually
anarchist
a total
the word.
Mess up.
Disorganised.
All round. And of course, in terms of getting the vote extended, the property classes clutched their pearls closer to their chests, and it probably put back real reform of the voting system by a generation.
So Joe,
it's not necessarily a positive.
Although they did, I mean, the Whigs did introduce.
Well, they did bring, in 1834. Reform. They did reform it. Yeah.
So, yeah.
And that's partly because they were. I suppose you could argue it's
it was
because
32. I think it was.
Yeah, we've got to do something about this. Mm. But nevertheless, most of the rioters wouldn't have been people who would have been able to vote with the reform anyway.
No,
they were way outside the political system.
Coming back to St James, I heard that a lot of them were from the St James district.
Yeah,
near St James's Priory, because that was by that point. Very poor district of Bristol. Yeah. You know, all the wealthy had gone up to Clifton.
That's kind of disappeared by St James's district, though, isn't it? Apart from the Priory, because it was bombed in World War II, I think, and then a big road driven through it. Or is it the Bear Pit, actually, I think?
Bear Pit is St James Barton.
But anyway, going back to 1831, weren't there also quite a lot of consequences, trials and executions and things?
I think dozens of people were executed. There was serious, you know, retribution. I think, and Bristol was under a kind of military control for about 4 months afterwards.
It was the biggest riot in terms of death ever in this country. And it's the only time that things happened in Britain which are similar to what took place in France in the previous generation.
So there was this, no wonder the ruling classes were getting the biting their finger down.
And it was a period of revolution in Europe at the time.
That's right.
In 1830.
So, all of these things were underlying all of it. And Bristol was an important place. I mean, it subsequently lost its place in the hierarchy to places like Liverpool and Manchester and the northern industrial towns, because Bristol did have industry, but not in that kind of scale. There was a textile factory, a cotton factory built in Barton Hill, which is why Barton Hill exists, and there was a lot of mining, but it really didn't take, that kind of industry wasn't really feasible in Bristol. Mm. Yeah. Now, it was much more feasible in South Lancashire.
I'm trying to figure out how this fits in with Chartism. Was it Chartism after this?
Chartism from the 1840s.
Right. Okay, but it's linked, isn't it? Because it's all about, look, hang on, you guys are just running the country in your own interest, and we're starving and cold and dying. And I'm wondering whether there aren't some echoes today with all of this.
It was a very tumultuous period, that decade of the 1830s, the start of the Victorian era. And one link, I just want to make this quick link to St. James's Priory, because this thing I find fascinating is that you had St. James's Fair, which goes on from the 12th century. There's the charter giving St. James's Priory a fair, and it goes on all the way through from the 12th century, pretty much every single year, until 1838. When it's ended, because it's seen as this, congregation of vice and debauchery.
Oh no!
And they get the early Victorians get rid of it.
Yeah, I saw the same. I remember we're living over in Oxfordshire. They had the Forest Fair one of the big, I can't remember the name of it, one of the big houses, I think it's Wychwood Forest, and a massive fair once a year. And the same period, there was just a decision was made, no, we're going to stop these forest fairs because it attracts, crime and this sort of thing.
The wrong class of person.
So it's not controlled, it's all sort of traditional and great, load of fun for all the locals, and a few bob to be made for travellers and itinerants of various sorts. But no, a lot of that stuff was extinguished, wasn't it?
Yeah. They also brought in the workhouse at this period. Yeah. This is where the wealthier classes decided they were going to make a bit of an effort to control the behaviour of the poor. Previously, they just ignored them and just kept them down. Now they're going to intervene in their lives and you're going to go to a workhouse and then we're going to show you what works.
Who was it that decided we were going to get rid of the Ashton Court Festival and have the Harbour Festival instead? You know, the Ashton Court Festival was great fun, loads of music, lots and lots of, all free, paid for by the City Council. And the Harbour Festival is just, it just doesn't compare to it at all.
The Harbour Festival has got a wider participation.
Really?
Yeah, lots of people go to it, whereas the Ashton Court Festival is for people who like that kind of
music.
It's
what I'd call a sticky bun affair, though. There's nothing really to it, the Harbour Festival. The Ashton Court Festival was a music festival, it was a proper cultural event.
Those are the days, when the City Council funded free festivals.
Yeah, which they still do all the time in France, by the way. Anyway, right, any final comments on these riots before we move on to a final item about what's happening in the United States?
Well, I said bring it more up to date. You had the St. Paul's riots. Nothing really. There was the Stokes Croft riots, weren't there?
They called the Tesco riots. Yeah.
Well, we covered that at the time. There was a lot of questions to ask about that.
Right.
I mean, it was a police riot, wasn't it?
Yeah, because what happened was there was a big, successful, non-violent protest against Tesco's opening. They put a picket line on Tesco's on Stokes Croft just up the road here. And if people round here, if you put a picket line and say, don't go in, we want Tesco's to close, they don't go in. And they were actually losing money. And it looks as if it was going to close down. Then what happened, Telegraph Heights, which was a squat on the
Telegraphic
other side.
Heights.
Telegraphic Heights was on the we called call Telegraphic Heights, on the other side of the road.
Telepathic
Heights, sorry. There was supposedly some young lads in there making petrol bombs. And on the basis of that, three different police forces turned up at 9 o'clock at night and took control of Stokes Croft around where we are. Now, there's some dispute in my mind whether any petrol bombs were being made in Telegraphic Heights.
Pathic.
But even if they were, there must have been prior knowledge, because I think somebody did a Freedom of Information request, and 12 different police forces were involved in that. And they turned out, I'd left the area just before it happened, and there was nothing going on. It was the weekend of a royal wedding, I think, so everybody was out in the streets having a drink. And then suddenly this armed police force turned up in huge numbers from South Wales in particular and from Devon and Cornwall. And they started beating people up and bullying people around. And people didn't riot. They just refused to go home and stood in front of them. And eventually at 3 o'clock in the morning, they packed up and went home. But we had loads of stories from people that the Welsh police in particular had been told, we're going to St. Paul's. And they'd got the real attitude. And they beat people up, and there's people having their shop windows smashed and all sorts. Mm. And the whole thing, to me, looks as if it had been orchestrated in advance, because Bristol's got a reputation...
Colin Port, I believe, was
Chief Constable. Bristol's got a reputation for protest. And I think what the deep state was looking for there is a violent riot, so that they can then say, well, look, these people are violent and all the rest of it. What was interesting about it, because most of the people who were standing up for the police were what you might call your middle-class protester rioters. The real hardcore lads from down the front line didn't take part, because it was nothing to do with them. As far as they were concerned, it was nothing, and they weren't going to get involved.
We're just going to cover a couple of more stories before we close. One is Scottish independence. Poor old Scots being told that they can't do it. Have their vote by Westminster. This isn't fair, is it? Isn't it absolutely dreadful? Westminster lording it over poor old Holyrood.
Well, they've got a similar dilemma to the people in Catalonia who want to leave Spain. Two things: they've not quite got a majority either in Catalonia or in Scotland. It's just not quite there. Similarly in Northern Ireland.
Well, speaking on the BBC, Lord Sumption said that this is actually, that Lincoln Sturgeon doesn't really want a referendum, but she wants to be able to say, oh, it's Westminster that stopped us having
it. Yes, I think...
There's a lot of game playing going on.
There is
on.
A lot of game playing going on, and of course in Northern Ireland people are well aware of the consequences of getting it wrong as well. You know, it's not a joke. But of course, in principle... Like, this is Craig Murray's argument, who's a former British ambassador to Uzbekistan. He's strongly in favour of Scottish independence. Lots of countries do declare independence without the central government approving it.
UDI, man. Come on, Nicola, get on with it.
Well, that's what Kosovo did when they broke out of Serbia, and NATO went to war to enforce their decision.
Council on Foreign Relations, Nicola Sturgeon.
This is exactly what the Eastern Ukrainians have done. They voted in referendums to leave Ukraine.
European Council on Foreign Relations stooge, Nicola Sturgeon, put your money where your mouth is, babe.
Craig Murray and others are suggesting that she should just go for an illegal vote. But they did that in Catalonia, and it didn't work. And you can do that. They did it in the Baltic states, but you've got to have overwhelming support if you're going to do
which
that.
Which they don't have.
But Martin, you're an economics guy. Is it economically feasible?
Yeah. I mean, Scotland is about the same size as Denmark. Mm. And they look across the sea to Norway, which has got a smaller population, and they've got, you know, nursery schools, pensions, all paid for by the oil, which is owned by the government. I used to work in Scotland quite a lot, because I used to go backwards and forwards to Scotland. And, of course, they rightly see themselves as a small European country that's been bullied by the English for generations. I've got every sympathy.
Anyway, 3,000 miles west of us, we've got Donald Trump, who's announced last week that he's going to be running for US president. So let's have a couple of minutes of his pronouncements, where he talks about, amongst other things, some of his little private dealings with the Chinese President Xi.
I didn't need this. I had a very nice, easy life. This is something I didn't need, and a lot of you people don't need either. But we love our country, and we have to take care of our country. We have to save our country. Every policy must be geared toward that which supports the American worker, the American family, and businesses, both large and small, and allows our country to compete with other nations on a very level playing field, which we never had until I came along and the Trump administration came along. And now we're losing it. They're moving back into China. They're moving back into these other countries. It's horrible. That means low taxes, low regulations, and fair trade, much of which I've already completed, but now will even greatly enhance. Other countries should pay for the privilege of coming into the American marketplace. They have to pay to come into our country and make all of that money, take it away from us. And thanks to the Trump administration, still the best and the biggest country in the world is what we have. We have the best and the biggest. If you remember, for many years, you can look in your projection books, China was going to take over from us as the largest economy in the world in 2018 or 2019. I said, I don't like that timing. And I was with President Xi, who's now president for life. I call him king. He said, no, I'm not the king. I said, yes, you are the king. You're president for life. It's the same thing. But I said, President, you can't do these things. You can't. Remember, they had China 25. That means China was going to take over virtually the whole world economy by 25. I said, that's not a nice sign. I don't want that sign. They took it down. They took down the whole slogan. Probably will be coming back at some point in the near future. But I found it very insulting. I said, I find that very insulting. On day one, we will end Joe Biden's war on American energy. And you will see, when that happens, you will see energy costs come down. And because energy is so big and so important, you will see inflation dropping. You will see it come down. It's a thing of beauty. And you wouldn't think it's that complicated. Now, what has been complicated a little bit is what's happened to so many other things. I believe originally started by this energy disaster. We were $1.87 a gallon for gasoline, and now it's hitting $5, $6, $7, and even $8, and it's going to go really bad. The socialist disaster known as the Green New Deal, which is destroying our country, and the many crippling regulations that it has spawned, will be immediately terminated so that our country can again breathe and grow and thrive like it should.
So that's Donald Trump there, a part of his speech. Do you think he'll get the nomination, guys? Do you think he'll win, Joe, first?
He sounds pretty underpowered, doesn't he? Does he really believe it? I don't know. I don't know enough about Republican politics to know if he'll get the nomination. I don't think he'll win. I don't think the energy is there.
Martin?
Well, he's obviously intending to run, and if he doesn't get the nomination, he may stand against whoever does. But that means that under the first past the post car crash that is the US electoral system, the Democrats will undoubtedly win in that case. So they're probably crossing their fingers that he does stand, but not as the Republican nominee. So that, you know, this is the kind of, you know, this is the kind of mess that we're looking at. It's just, you know, and what he's talking about, we used to have a fair playing field. The US is a massive predator state. A huge amount of resources is sucked out of the rest of the world into their stock market every day. And they don't have to balance the books because everybody else has to pay for their military, which they then use to bully everybody into line. And the idea that they've been put upon by the poor old Chinese and everybody else putting upon them, this is just revanchism. Yeah. The argument inside the ruling class in the US is do we kill Russia first or do we kill China first? But of course the Russians and the Chinese are listening to this argument as they argue amongst themselves which they're going to fight first.
We had in the first part with Anton Chaykin talking about, are you going to have a multipolar world with independent industrial powers around the world? This is the Michael Hudson argument too, or is there going to be a globalist financial elite dominating the rest of them?
Well, this is what we're going through. Is we're now
Trump is definitely on the multipolar side of that, isn't he?
Well, no, he isn't. He's on the unipolar side of it for the United States. Yeah, nobody in the United States is in favour of multilateralism.
But that's not realistic, is it?
No, it isn't realistic because, unfortunately for them, China is the workshop of the world. That's just what happens, you know. Like Britain became the workshop of the world, and then America became the workshop of the world. Once that's moved on, and it should move on, yeah. The whole promise of capitalism is that everybody gets a go to be the leader. And that's where we're going now. In actual fact, what's really interesting to me is that I think there's going to be a major crash in the Europe, which is then going to affect the US. Have the Chinese and the Russians done enough to keep themselves afloat in the middle of that crash? And they're working very hard on trying to make sure that they won't be affected by all of this. The Russians are, for example, virtually self-sufficient in everything. They've worked very hard on this in the last 10 years.
Joe, how do you see Britain relating to the States these days? Are we just literally a little minion that doesn't actually have any freedom of our own? We're given a little bit, maybe, to make it look as if we've got some freedom. It does seem as if we're now just a kind of adjunct of this US empire.
Yeah, in many ways we are. We're a colony, aren't we? And that happens on many, many different levels. It's happened culturally.
Well, the Americans had their War of Independence. Do you think we might wrestle free from being just a colony to America?
I guess, well, if American decline continues, then maybe, yeah, we'll become a colony of someone else.
Anyway. One of the things, the British have played a particularly pernicious role in relation to the Ukraine. So in April this year, Zelensky was negotiating with the Russians via Erdogan in Istanbul, and they got a deal on the table. And then Boris Johnson, still the Prime Minister, turned up and told Zelensky, don't sign any deals with the Russians, and if you do, we won't accept
them.
Well,
actually,
he was speaking on behalf of the Americans.
Martin, is this the same time that Zelensky was threatened with being killed if
he didn't
sign any deals?
That's right. Well, Zelensky was elected by 70%.
Maybe that was MI6 guy who was there with Boris.
Yeah, but the British have paid a very... I mean, the British ambassador was called in Moscow a couple of weeks ago and said, we know that your people were behind the attack on the Kerch Bridge, the bombing of the Nord Stream pipeline, and
but can
and
Britain
so on.
Win a war with Russia?
No.
Why are we trying to start one then?
Well, you may well
ask.
We
think maybe we think the Germans are going to fight it for us.
As I said earlier, the head of the British Army, whose name now escapes me, not the brightest tool in the box, I would suggest, is saying the British people have got to get ready for a generation of war with Russia. Now, if he thinks that the British people are all geared up for a generation of war with Russia, despite all the propaganda, he's deluded. Because a war with Russia, when we were fighting in Korea, the top rate of tax was 95%. Perhaps the wealthy don't have to think about that. 95%. And rationing.
I wonder whether the British ruling class are actually, although they can't win it, they are actually more afraid of the Russians than anyone else.
Because
the Russians are rational.
They are doing what the Americans want. I don't suppose for a moment that Boris Johnson went to talk to Zelensky without having cleared it with the Americans. But nevertheless, he chose to be the messenger. And that's Britain punching above its weight. In actual fact, frustrating a peace deal.
Yeah.
And, of course, the British Special Forces and Intelligence Service have been heavily involved in all sorts of atrocities
in
the Ukraine.
On a positive note, because the START talks are beginning on the 29th of November, a week of talks between the US and the Russians about... reducing the strategic nuclear forces. So that's definitely one to keep an eye on. And it's at least they are actually talking to each other about this sort of thing. The intermediate nuclear forces, that is to say the tactical nuclear weapons and things like that, are not part of the talks, but at least the big strategic weapons are. Anyway, time to sign off now. Thanks to our guest, Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers, and our sound engineer Dave Bezenko, also to local freelance journalist Joe Banks. And download our MP3s to listen in the car or anywhere you like. Find interviews for me if you want, and send them to me via the Not the BCFM Politics Show page, where you'll also find the podcast, full-length interviews, story links, comment page, and our email addresses. You can subscribe to my weekly email list too, and even donate if you want at thisweekoneword.org.uk. This show is repeated at 11 p.m. Fridays and at 11 and 5 a.m. and p.m. all week on the PRSC stream. And over Sunday tea time now at CamberleysRadioQUK.com. Do please feel free to make live recordings. We've been streaming live from the People's Republic of Stokes Croft in Bristol on the talkradio.org.uk stream, at RadioQUK.com in Camberley, Surrey, and live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app. If you can restream us live or rebroadcast us, just let me know and I'll credit you here. Have a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join us for Not the BCFM Politics Show live stream on talkradio.org.uk and the app at 5 o'clock next Friday. God bless, and don't let the Illuminati banksters get you down.
The grand facade so soon will burn.